Retro Game Radio 2005. Keep it retro.
Retro gaming radio.
Today we have another game for the 22 and
Kimberly, come in. Are you okay?
You're now listening to Retro Gaming Radio.
And you're listening to Retro Gaming Radio.
Welcome to the program. Retro Gaming Radio 2005. Keep it retro.
Hello, folks. Welcome to the October 2005 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. This is Shane R. Monroe, your host. Welcome to the program. My, we do have a very busy show this month. We have part two of our interview with the great Jerry Lawson, the man responsible for the Fairchild Channel F video game console. I cut you off at just the right time last month. You're going to love the rest of this interview. Really good stuff. Hey, we're also going to take a look at Taito Legends for the PC. The PC edition of Taito Legends, which brings back tons of classic Taito games, including my all-time favorite, Zookeeper. And how does that stand up to regular emulation? How does that stand up against the arcade version? We're going to tell you all about it this show. We're also going to take a preview look at the very exciting, highly anticipated successor to the Game Park 32, the GP32 unit from Game Park Holdings, the GP2X, which is the GP32's big brother. It's a portable media gaming emulation system. Basically, it's your PlayStation Portable without all the funky lockdowns and the firmware crap. This is what's going to be the future of portable emulation, I'm here to tell you. And we got a whole preview of some great little exclusive tidbits coming to you right here this month on Retro Gaming Radio. Along with that, we have, of course, our huge Bits and Bytes section. I've got absolutely tons of crap to cover in Bits and Bytes. And, of course, new editorial commentary this month on what I think I've found really works for me in video games, greed. I know I've touched on it in the past, but I decided to dedicate this month's editorial commentary to it because I'm really starting to miss not having new games that feature a lot of greed. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. We got all this and so much more this month on Retro Gaming Radio. For this month's editorial commentary, I'd like to talk to you about greed. And it's not the kind of greed you're probably thinking I'm going to talk about. Corporate greed, greed of EA, greed of video game mongols. You know, greed comes in many different shapes and sizes. Greed is what drives our economy. Greed is what Generation Gimme is all about. But I want to talk about a different kind of greed, maybe a healthier kind of greed. I was recently looking over Taito Legends for the PC, which we have a full review of in this show, so you'll want to definitely tune into that. And I was playing Zookeeper. Not the Zookeeper that came out on the Nintendo DS, which is your basic Bejeweled knockoff, but the old arcade Taito game of Zookeeper. Now, for those of you who are not intimate with Zookeeper, and I don't know how you couldn't be having listened to this show for 7 years, Zookeeper is a very simple game. It's a top-down view of a bunch of animals locked in four brick walls. You, as the Zookeeper Zeke, run around the outside of the walls. As you run around, it rebuilds the walls because the animals eat away at it. See, they want out. So as you run around this, you know, the circumference of this cage, you rebuild the bricks that they chew up. Now, inevitably, some of these animals escape. When they escape, they enter your playing field, the edge of the zoo, right? So you have to jump over them to avoid being killed. Very simplex. I mean, this is not nearly as complicated as I'm making it sound. And during the gameplay, this timer, this fuse is burning down. And periodically, during that timer, they'll put up special items like goodies for you to collect for points. But at some point in time, they put up a net. And when that net shows up, you can touch the net. And that gives you momentarily the power to send all of these little bastards back into their cage. Now, if you've been a good boy and you've kept the wall well built, you might be able to keep them in there till the end of the round. And the end of the round is what you're working for. Because at the end of the round, all of the animals that you've managed to keep caged are worth points. The badder ass the animal is, the more points they're worth. So you're probably saying to yourself, well, that makes good sense, right? You keep the animals in, you put the animals back in, you get the points. Case closed. Now, if that was the whole point of the game, doing that over and over again with just faster and faster animals, the game probably wouldn't hold the mega appeal for me that it does. However, there's a caveat to this game. When you jump the animals, it's worth points. If you jump over one animal, you get like 100 points. If you jump over two animals, the more animals you jump in one single jump, the higher the point value. That's the bottom line. But it goes up like exponentially, which is really creepy. Because it's like, it's worth 100, and then like 500, then 1,000, then 2,000, then like 5,000, 10,000, 30,000. It's actually possible to score a 1 million point jump. That's right. One jump, 1 million points. That's insane. But you know, it takes a perfect act in order to make that happen. The biggest jump I've ever got was a 500,000 point jump. I don't even know how many animals are because they're all clustered together. You can't tell. In an average game, if you do not aggressively pursue the multiple animal jump scenario, you will in fact end up with a score of about 160,000 points. One jump can get you 1 million points. One jump changes 160,000 into 700 or 800,000. That's insanity, right? That's what makes that game truly unbelievable. It's about greed. It's not just about points. It's about willing to throw down your life in the chance of getting that 50,000, 100,000, 500,000 point jump. And believe me, the allure is horrible. Because if you play the game over and over again without using that mentality, you will simply score in the low 100,000s. It's just, if you want to exceed in this game, you have to take the risk. And then once you start taking the risk, that's all you want to do is take the risk. The game isn't about keeping the animals in the cage. Hell, I'd rather keep them out of the cage. But the strategies are to get the animals to run the same direction, to get them to bunch up, to get them to group so that you can jump them and score that 1 million point jump. Right? So, it's a very detailed game in terms of strategy. But the underlying point is greed. Let's talk about another game that I am totally in love with that actually sexually arouses me, and that is Robotron. Look at Robotron. Now, we've talked about Robotron a billion times. Let's talk about the greed element. As you know, if you've ever played Robotron, part of the appeal of the game is it's a mindless blaster. I mean, you're just, everything is moving at such light speeds. I don't care how good you are at Quake. You get behind a Robotron machine for the first time, you're going to turn to jelly. But the greed factor of it comes into play with the humanoids. While you're busily blasting away the level, which is what you're supposed to do, that's the aim of the game. Remove all the enemies from the screen and you'll go to the next screen. But on every screen you got these little humans running around. Now you don't have to save them. It's completely optional. You can move to the next level without so much as picking up one of them. And for the most part, well, I guess not for the most part, they're also susceptible to being killed by Robotrons in the area. Grunts will run over them and kill them. They can be changed into enemies by the brains, right? And those are potential points lost. But what makes the brilliance of Robotron and the point system is the humanoids go up in value. The first one that you pick up on the same level, you pick up number one, it's worth 1,000 points. You pick up number two, it's worth 2,000 points. Pick up the third one, 3,000, 4,000, and so on. At 5,000, it peaks. So for every enemy after that, you get a cool $5,000. Literally, your score can double or triple on certain levels simply because of the mass of humanoids that if you play your cards right, you can sack down 10 of them, right? 10, 15 of these guys, And you got to do the math. The first five are worth 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5,000, right? And then everything after that's worth $5,000. That's the only way to really, really score high in that game is to utilize the humanoid multiplier. You will literally see great Robotron players, which I am not. I am an average Robotron player. But if you look at some of the really good Robotron players, like our buddy Brian King from ArcadeRestoration.com, it's all about greed, man. You will see people risk life and limb to get that last humanoid. Why? Because right now, that humanoid is worth 5,000. On the next level, it's going to be worth, the first one you hit is going to be $1,000. There's a huge difference in this, and it's greed. It's greed on a level that is so subtle. It's so easy to get absorbed into. It's insane. It reminds me a lot of the games where you get bonuses for consecutive perfect shots. I think Area 51 does it. Target Terror does it. Every time you get a 100% accurate shot, you know, the first one you hit, then you get a times 2 multiplier, times 3 multiplier, times 4 multiplier. But as soon as you miss, you go back down to 1x. There is a magic about that particular methodology. Rewarding you at great lengths for taking great risks. And you can see some of the flavor of this in other games, like, say, Gauntlet. Right? How many times have you bustled through a pack of ghosts knowing that there's food over there? In your mind, you've already mentally calculated how much health you'll lose on the trip from where you are to where the food is. And in getting the food, you will compensate what you lost and then get some extra over the top of what you've lost. How many times have you sucked up tons of health damage to get a potion instead of shooting it? Same idea. I think one of the great things that we miss out on in modern gaming is the greed factor. Look at it. Look at, say, Defender. I think Defender was like this, or was it Stargate? A little hazy on this one. But you used to get a bonus multiplier for how many humanoids you had picked up, so it was probably Stargate. If you had one humanoid in your possession and you landed, or you went down to the surface, then you got like 1,000. But for every humanoid you had after that in your possession, you would get a multiplier. Right? So you're going to carry those stupid humanoids around. Instead of scoring safely, pick up a humanoid, drop him, 1,000. Pick up a humanoid, drop him, 1,000. You're going to carry a couple of those guys around. Dino Eggs, the Commodore 64 and the Apple II, someday I will finish my translation of for the PC. That game is about greed. It doesn't look like it's about greed. You run around, you pick up eggs, you warp out with them, repeat as necessary till the level's cleared of eggs, and you move on. That's the way it's supposed to be. But then they throw this little thing at you. You can only carry 3 eggs at a time. Well, that kind of sucks, because you're making a lot of trips back and forth. But if you pick up a power flower, you can carry as many eggs as you want. And you're thinking, well, that's a great deal. But the problem is, while you get a great little bonus for carrying that many eggs back to your warp, if you get contaminated by touching anything on the screen, and believe me, it's really easy for that to happen, you lose them all. Again, great risk, great reward. And I love that. I mean, I kept going through the games in my palette of taste of games. And every time I turn around, I keep seeing more and more greed. Mr. Do, it's about greed. Oh no, you can say that it's about clearing the screen of the bad guys or dropping the apples or whatever. That's not what it's about. It's about greed. You know why? Because you get an exponential score based on the number of bad guys you can crush with a single apple. You crush one, 500. You crush like 6 of them, you get like $5,000. It's insane. These are the games that continually bring me back to the plate so that I might possibly refine the greed process. You don't see greed. I mean, you look at games like, say, God of War on the PlayStation 2. Great game. Probably one of the best games I've played in a decade. Game ain't about greed. There's no greed in there. It's possible to make a great game without greed. But imagine if we'd managed to chuck some greed in there. Right? Imagine if we'd managed to tap that system. Look at, say, Burnout. Burnout 3, you know, Legends, whatever you want to play. Burnout. Burnout, there's not a lot of greed in there. There's a little bit of greed in the crash mode, but that's kind of like the default play of the crash mode, is designed to do damage, right? So it's not an underlying factor. It's not a modifier of the original game. It is the game, and that's different. The best greed games are the games that don't use greed as the primary focus. You can say a lot of games that are based on a monetary system are about greed, but they're really not. It's an integral part of the standard game. If you need to buy better armor, you need cash, right? So of course you're going to knock every barrel over, you're going to open every chest, because the commerce piece is part of the natural order of the game. You can't get farther in the game without cash. It's not an enticement, it's a requirement. The best games, the best greed games of all time, like Zookeeper and Robotron, are all brilliant games in their own right. But as soon as you throw that taste of greed, you can take the chance. You can lose a lot. But if you're willing to play... Here's another good example. Actually, it's not a good example, but it's an interesting example. On Galaga 88, being able to start with an extra ship, but you lose one of your ships, that's a trade-off. But it's not greed. Now, Galaga 88's a great game. No lie right there. But that's an integral part of the game, where it's not like... The capturing of your ship is a perfect example of greed. Not over-excessive, but you're willing to possibly throw down an extra life, or one of your lives, in order to possibly get a better ship. Let's talk about greed. Let's talk about Deluxe Galaga, a.k.a. Warblade, on the PC. That game's about greed. You will go out of your way to do the greediest, nastiest things you can in the chance that you're going to pick up a great weapon by picking up the question mark, or you're going to pick up the cash multiplier. You're willing to take a chance grabbing that question mark. You could lose every weapon you have, but at the same time, you could be richly rewarded. We're willing to take on the Meteor Storm, even though it's an optional part of the game. We're willing to take on the Meteor Storm or the Memory Challenge. Well, the Memory Challenge, I mean, these don't cost you anything, but they're nice incentives. I guess that was a bad example. I get kind of segued onto the whole Deluxe Galaga thing. But you guys get my point, right? I think that we're missing a piece of greed. Look at even games that are spin-offs of these great classics. Smash TV, great game in its own right, but is it about greed? It's really not. It's not about greed in the way Robotron is. Tempest is not a game about greed. Black Widow, another Robotron clone, no greed in there. Didn't get into that one very much. I mean, I like it, but you know, whatever. Let me tell you one of the best greed games of all time. Top Gunner, a.k.a. Jackal. I know I've talked about it on the show before, but I got a lot of new people listening. Top Gunner is a top-down, four-directional scrolling game where you drive a Jeep around, but you can take a friend with you. You can play two players at once. You drive a Jeep through enemy lines. You blow stuff up, tanks, bunkers, all this stuff. Submarines come out of the water. It's a pretty fun game. It's a finite game. There's a beginning and an end, and once you've been to the end, the game's kind of over. But this game has one of the best greed systems ever, and I'll explain it to you. When you blow open a bunker, the little guys come running out. You can pick these guys up in your Jeep, but you only carry like 8 of them. Now, there are some of these guys that are like super dudes. You pick up the super dude, and it automatically upgrades the weapon on your Jeep. But if you've already filled your Jeep to capacity, you can't pick the guy up. And there's no way to drop the dudes off except for like at these helipads. You got to stop at the helipad and let the dudes out. Now, this is absolutely brilliant. You carry 8 dudes. And again, this is an exponential thing. The first guy that gets out and makes it to the helo without getting killed is worth X points. The next guy is worth like twice as much. The next guy is worth twice as much on top of that. The next guy is worth twice as much on top of that. The last guy that gets out, number 8, is worth like 20 or 50 grand, which is like the whole sum of your score of the game if you were playing it without knowing these things. Of course, the great risk is, and part of the deal is you can't move while they get out. When you plant your Jeep on the helipad and these guys start getting out, if you move, it restarts the count over again. So if you let three guys out and then you just move the joystick a little bit, the next guy comes out at 100 points instead of 10,000 the way it's supposed to be. You have to remain absolutely still. I don't think the game's just going to stop and let you drop these guys off. Planes come flying overhead, dropping bombs on you. Again, are you willing to risk that bomb hopefully not hitting you while you're dropping those guys off because you want the big payout? Did I also mention that no matter what weapon you have in your Jeep, if you pull that off, if you pull off the 8-man drop, instantly you are automatically upgraded to the absolute best weapon you can have? That's greed, my friend. That's greed, and it's not something you see now. Games don't have that kind of greed element anymore. I'm sitting here looking at my massive Nintendo DS collection. Not a lot of greed here. Meteos has a little bit of greed. You know, the same like Puyo Pop and Tetris. You're willing to stack things up, hoping to get that one piece that'll pull the Tetris off. Right? So there's a little bit of that, but you know, overall, there's not a whole lot of games about greed here. And I really miss out on that. I think that greed and video games go hand in hand. And I think it's time that we saw it start coming back. Maybe you've seen a game that's all about greed. The kind of greed that we're talking about. If you manage to come across something like that, don't be shy. Come to the message forums and drop us a line and let us know about what you found. Because I'm looking for a good greed game. And there's just not a lot of them out here anymore. I mean, I go back to the classics, the Robotrons, the Zookeepers, because they give me a level of greed that is just simply unparalleled. Try Top Gunner. I mean, those of you who are into emulation, it's in MAME. It's perfectly emulated, finally. So give it a try. I think Jackal on the NES, a lot of people are like, oh, I'll play Jackal on the NES. Not the same. It's got the right idea, but it's not quite good enough. You got to play like the full arcade version. Anyway, I didn't want to run this particular commentary for too long because we've got way too much show to get to, but I figure about 20 minutes is a good commentary, right? Hopefully it gives everybody something to think about, maybe go try out and see if you can find some other greed games on your own. Do listen on for the Tato Legends review where I talk about Zookeeper as it's properly emulated, believe it or not, inside your PC without MAME, where you can legally purchase this and 34 other really, really good games. So stick around for the rest of the show and hear our review of Tato Legends until next month when we have another editorial commentary on Retro Gaming Radio. All right, so this month we're going to look at another emulation package called Tato Legends out for PC, Xbox, PS2. I haven't seen a GameCube version kicking around yet, but hopefully soon. Normally when we discuss these emulation packages, you hear a rather nasty sneer in my voice. You can always expect the hammer to fall when it comes to emulation packages. Simply because most of the time they're just not good enough. Let's be honest. They falter in so many different possible areas. The emulation is inaccurate. Timing's off, sound effects are really horrible. We're getting the same game shoveled to us as we've been given shoveled to us for years, decades sometimes. Seems nobody wants to release anything new, as well as anything that's actually accurate. Now, of course, the PC and Xbox versions, both being basically PCs, already have a dedicated, well-thought-out emulation process behind it already. It's the biggest platform for emulation. Emulation's all perfected on the PC architecture, so it makes good sense that the Xbox and PC versions are as accurate as emulation you can get elsewhere, providing they cared enough to license the best stuff. Now, the PS2, on the other hand, usually ends up coming up like crap. This month, I managed to get my paws on the PC version of it, $19.95, decent price. So we're going to look at that this month, and as soon as I can get my paws on a PS2 version, we'll take a look at that one in comparison and contrast and how well they did that. But let's talk about the PC version this month. First of all, one of my biggest complaints with emulation is the lack of titles or the similarity of titles to past packages, right? I mean, let's be honest. How many times do we have to have Pac-Man, Ms. Pac-Man, Rally X, Galaga? Those are the big ones. Those are the ones that seem, for some reason, every 5 years get released again and again and again and again. How many times do we need to see these titles? Well, Taito has a very quirky game library anyway. And as you all know, Taito has a huge collection of outstanding games. So when I heard that Taito Legends was going to have like 35 games, that's insanity. What a great set of games. It actually turned out to be more like 29 games. But that's okay. I mean, 29's okay. I can live with that. That's still, I think, bigger than any other version. Any other emulation package, for that matter. I think we had like 22 with one of the Midway Arcade treasures, right? So 29's a good number. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking with 29 games, we should be able to get the absolute cream of the Taito crop. I mean, that's like all the good games, right? Well, it's obvious that Taito is not unlike any other company, and they'd like to hold back a couple of their premier titles for the next release. So, we do not have a couple of the titles where you go, oh, what do you mean that's not on there? Things like Arkanoid, right? You'd expect that sort of thing to be on there. But unfortunately, it is not. However, let's not talk about what's not on there. Let's talk about what is on there. The list, again, is 29 games. I'm going to run through these. I imagine if there's any weird names in here, I'll probably butcher them, but that's just my nom de plume. Battle Shark, Bubble Bobble, Colony 7, Continental Circus, Electric Yo-Yo, Elevator Action, Exisus, yeah, there's one, Gladiator, Great Swordsman, Jungle Hunt, Ninja Kids, The New Zealand Story, Operation Thunderbolt, Operation Wolf, Phoenix, Plotting, Plump Pop, Rainbow Islands, Rastan, Return of the Invaders, Space Guns, Space Invaders Part 2, Super Kicks, Thunder Fox, Tokyo, Tubit, Volfied, and of course, Zookeeper. Zookeeper. Yes, my friends, the magic has happened. Zookeeper has finally been put on an official emulation package. Thank God. Now somebody other than me and two other people will have heard of it and know how to play it. So, part of the importance of reviewing emulation is to stick with what you know. Because emulation is very, very personal to people, right? And part of emulation is going back to your nostalgia. Now, if I'm not highly nostalgic about a particular title, or I don't have a lot of playtime on it, I can't decide whether the emulation is good or not. So I've decided to stick with about 5 titles in this collection that I played until my fingers bled, and that gives me a good position to tell you how accurate they are and how well they're done. So we're going to look at a couple of titles here. We're going to look at Rastan, Phoenix, Operation Wolf, Jungle Hunt, Elevator Action, and Zookeeper. Rastan, for example, goes way back for me. It's actually one of the newer games on the list, and yet, for some reason, my memory of it goes farther back, simply because outside of regular PC emulation from time to time, it's just not something that I engaged in. What really drew me into Rastan was the music. Of course, as a geek, I was a, you know, Wizards and Warlocks fanatic, you know, so seeing this big, you know, badass guy with a badass sword running around hacking things up, I mean, that appealed to me. But the music in the arcade really, really grabbed me. You know, I ended up playing it just to listen to the music. I thought it was a brilliant composition. So I started playing it, and it's a decent game overall, of course. Rastan is a side-scroller platformer type game. Standard fare, there's really nothing totally great about the title, but the music. I mean, when I think Rastan, I think music. And to me, that's one of the most important parts of emulation is sound. Sound has been medically and psychologically proven to have actually more power in the chemical process to induce memories than even sight. It's really weird. I'd have to dig up the articles that I was reading about it, but they were talking about how you know, sound is more likely to take you back than visualizing something. So it's important that this emulation stuff has the proper sound. With Rastan, I was not disappointed. The game, of course, played flawlessly, and the music was dead on. Now, I don't know if it's because I have really cheap speakers on my PC. It's very possible. I don't remember this music sounding so hollow. It doesn't have the depth to it. I mean, it's the right music. I mean, every note's in place. But it doesn't have the deep, rich sound to it. And I've got to assume it's my crappy speakers, because everything else is dead on. So I'd be curious to see if anybody else thought it sounded kind of hollow. But again, you know, cheap equipment, you're going to get cheap sound effects out of it. What can I tell you? But the game plays perfect. This wasn't a game, really, though, that had problems with emulation that I remember. So I wasn't expecting it to be bad. But there's something about the music that if you monkey with the music, you know, you're monkeying with my soul, man. So the music's good to go. And the sound effects are all dead on. It didn't sound like there was any sample, you know, substitution. Everything was good, and I was very pleased. Phoenix, you know, I swear I must have had a bootleg copy of Phoenix in my local theater, because this is where I played Phoenix while I was waiting for a movie at the good old Liberty Cinema back in who the hell cares Washington. I used to play Phoenix like mad, and I swear that the sounds were a little different. But then I found out later on in life and through emulation that there were more pirated versions of Phoenix and all of those games of that era, you know, the Monkey Kong and the Puckman, or the, you know, the goofy Pac-Man at the laundromat that had like a handwritten marquee on it and the colors were all dorked up and none of the sounds were right. So, but the gameplay in Phoenix, of course, is dead on, as I was expecting it to be. And the sounds sound sort of weird to me. I'm not sure whether or not they're accurate to the arcade game or if it was just the version of it that I was playing that makes it sound differently. But I swore when you were on the flying birds, they're all flying birds, the eggs that fly by and then they morph into the big giant birds, when you hit their wings, it almost sounded like a digitized cry. I know it wasn't digital, but the sound effect they used made it almost sound like a bird cry. In this version of it, I just don't hear that. It sounds different and wrong to me. Now, again, you know, I could have had the wrong unit, you know, at the theater. So if anybody else has any insight on whether or not the birds sounded right in Phoenix and Tato Legends, let me know. But overall, everything played dead on. The controls are kind of wonky, though, in terms of the default control pattern, the controls for it. You use the arrow keys and the Z and X. I've never been a big fan of using actual keyboard keys. I'm much more attuned to the MAME's, you know, Control, Alt, and occasionally maybe the spacebar layout. As with all good emulation packages, however, you can redefine your keys, and nicely enough, Control and Alt actually do work. Some emulators, you can choose your keys as long as they're not Control and Alt, whatever that means. But anyway, so Phoenix looks like it's good to go. Again, one of those games that's near and dear to my heart because I played endless numbers of games of it. Operation Wolf. This is one of those kind of creepy games. Operation Wolf's a gun game, but it is of the generation of gun games that did not use light gun technology. Instead, like Terminator 2 and Revolution X, the gun is actually mounted on a swivel base, and the base itself is a joystick. So while it looks like you're actually shooting with these guns in a light-sensitive aim-pull-the-trigger scenario, you're really not. These games are all really joystick gun games that happen to have a gun mounted on top of the joystick. So I had fairly high hopes that they could get away with making Operation Wolf proper. I was not disappointed with Operation Wolf either. You can play with the joystick scenario, which is, by the way, forget about that, or you can play with the mouse, which originally I thought would give me a slight advantage over using like a gun-style control, But overall, it seemed to be okay. The game seemed to be fairly level, even using the mouse control instead of the joystick gun type control. So overall, I was impressed with that. Everything's there. The game settings, by the way, for these games are also settable. If you want to choose, you know, when your extra lives are, all the basic, quote, dip switch settings appear to be there. I did not go frame by frame and compare them against main, but the big daddy one seems to be there. None of the games that I've seen so far have a power-up mode, so it looks like the power-up piece of the emulation has been removed. Again, not a big deal for most people, but for you purists, you know, sometimes part of the cool thing of Williams games starting up is that weird, goofy, you know, graphic test screen. I don't know. It always makes me go back. What can I tell you? Jungle Hunt. Well, this is kind of weird because I played a lot more Jungle King than I did Jungle Hunt. And Jungle Hunt has you playing the part of like, I just lost completely, a jungle explorer, you know, with the hat, the big dome hat and the white outfit. You look like you're on safari. The version that I played more was with Tarzan, which was Jungle King. So I started playing this. I'm going, man, this is kind of funny. But I realized, oh, well, this isn't Jungle King. This is Jungle Hunt. Everything seems to be in place, though. The sounds seem okay. The speed of the emulation seems okay. Everything is as I remember it. So that's good to go, too. Elevator action. This is one that we've seen a few times in other emulation packages, and it's always pretty much dead on. This, too, is, of course, dead on. Sounds are as you'd expect them to be. The gameplay is as you remember it. Good stuff. So not much to really talk about there if you're an elevator action fan. Let's talk about Zookeeper, because Zookeeper, of course, is the nearest and dearest to my heart in this package. Zookeeper and I have had a very interesting past. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, man, you must have played Zookeeper a lot. You always talk about Zookeeper, and you're relating things to Zookeeper. And I know you just couldn't wait to talk about Zookeeper in this review. I'll be honest with you. I only played a real Zookeeper machine one time in my life. One time. It was a layover at a bus station. I got to play Zookeeper for about an hour and a half. And I played it for an hour and a half straight. I then loaded like every bit of pocket money I had. I must have been like 13 or something. And I was taking a bus either to my grandma's or to my father's for visitation, whatever. And so I remember just playing it and playing it and playing it. And I never saw it again. Ever. The first time I saw it again was in Maine. And I'll tell you what, it took a long time to get Zookeeper in Maine. I mean, it was almost to the point to where I was thinking about trying to write Zookeeper myself in like Blitz or some other language just because I wanted to play it so bad. Well, about the time I started thinking about taking up that project, somebody finally said, hey, you know, we got the dual Z80s working. I think we're going to be able to get Zookeeper in here. And lo and behold, Zookeeper did finally come along and come around, and we got it. So I've been playing a lot of Zookeeper emulated. So I have a good idea what this is supposed to feel like and look like. You'll be happy to know that everything is here. The creepy sound effects, the weird, sometimes pasted over each other graphics, all the little quirks are here. This is Zookeeper, folks, and thank God we finally got it in a home package. Like I said, maybe there'll be more than just three people that actually know what Zookeeper is then. That'd be a great plus. So anyway, so those kind of wrap up some of the real common games. Oh, by the way, you can change a couple of things. There's not a lot going on in here. It's not like MAME 32 where you can go through and check like 700 different possibilities. They give you like two options. You can turn on and off stretch, and you can turn on and off smoothing. Now, I'll tell you what, the games look good when you stretch them and smooth them. But for you purists out there, you know that that's not the right way to play these emulated games. Hardware stretch has always bothered me. I do not want to play Mr. Do, or in this case, Phoenix, in a bastardized horizontal aspect ratio where you stretch the screen out. It's not the same game when you do that. It just isn't. So fortunately, Tatum recognized this and allowed you to turn these two features off in their game package that would give you as close to the arcade experience with the right aspect ratio, the right pixely graphics. I mean, that's part of the deal. I mean, it's like, oh, it's all pixely. Whatever. You know, if you're worried about pixely, you better, like, go play your Xbox, okay? Because there's nothing wrong with pixely games when they come from, like, 1985. Overall, the package is very slick. Normally, I really don't care what the package looks like. I would just be happy if a stupid DOS box came up and said, enter 1 through 35 or 1 through 29 and play the game, as long as the game's right. I don't care about the slick interface. I don't care about how many movies or sales flyers get included with it. I care about, does the game play right? So we know that Tato Legends has the game played right thing down pat. We're good to go. In fact, if you poke through the directory structure, you'll actually see the ROM images. Now, one of these days I'm going to get experimental and drop these ROM images into MAME and see if they work. But most of these packages traditionally encrypt the ROMs or something to keep you from doing that. We'll see if Tato does that sometime. Maybe we'll do a follow-up story. But normally the only time that I care about an interface on these particular packages is if it's bad. And you know what I'm talking about, right? Midway Arcade Treasures, where you got to navigate through a stupid Egyptian pyramid, decode hieroglyphics. It was the That was the worst interface ever devised, pretty much ever. So now I look for really bad ones. Most of them are just there. They exist. They function as they need to. I haven't really seen a slick one yet. And Tato Legends isn't really overly slick. It's well done, but it's not something where you'd go, oh man, that's like the coolest thing ever. The interface more or less consists of some really nice music. Brian would have been pleased to hear this arcade remix that they've got going on in the menu. It's actually pretty good. Not as good as arcade turntablism, of course, but it's pretty good. You scroll through the games with the arrow keys, and you can get some background information and history on Tato. You can actually, as you scroll across the games, the actual arcade cabinet shows up so you can see it. Very cool, pretty clean. Of course, the problem with that is it runs a little on the slower side. Now, it could just be my crappy video card. I wouldn't expect to have a problem with my video card in Tato Legends. But a lot of times as you're mousing, or not mousing, but arrow keying over, right, to get to the game that you want, it'll buffer your keystrokes. So if Phoenix is five games over from where you're at and you start tapping the button to get over to Phoenix, it will cue all of those up. So if you hit it seven times, even though it takes you like X amount of time to get to that menu item, it'll continue to walk past it because you hit it too many times. That's kind of frustrating. When you want to get into a game right now, that pisses you off. So that's a real pisser. I hate that. But that's the only thing I'd count down on. Now, when you actually enter the game, you get some options. You can set up your basic game options, as I mentioned before. You can change your game controls. You can see some flyers, real basic stuff. It's nothing that's going to get you really excited in the extras department, but that's okay. Because this is what we came here for. Now, the settings are sticky, so if you go into Phoenix and you choose X setting and Y setting, they're going to be there when you get back. Very nice. That's something they didn't necessarily have to do, but they did good, and I'm pleased. So let's talk about this. We're starting to run a little long in the tooth here. I didn't want to talk this long, but Tato Legends is one of those rare, very solid emulation packages. I'm very pleased with it. I haven't had a chance to run through all 29 games. That's okay. What I really like to do, though, is bring back on the PS2 version of it, because that, to me, is the real test of how well Explosive, the company that did the title, how well they did it. Because it's easy to license MAME and throw some ROMs down and play it on a PC or an Xbox. But on the PS2, you're talking about a whole different animal, and I'm curious to see how they did that. So, Tato Legends from Explosive Slant Empire. 1995. You can order it at Amazon. You can pick it up almost locally anywhere. Good stuff. If you want a good representation of an arcade emulation package, and you've got a PC or, heaven forbid, an Xbox, this is the package that you want to show your friends. This is the package that you will hold up as reference material for future emulation packages. And let's hope that Taito sells enough of this stuff that they'll give us another one and fill in some of the gaming gaps that are missing here. There's not a lot. Hey, Zookeeper's in here. That's what I wanted from a Taito package. But other people have different needs, of course. So, Taito Legends, Explosive Slant, Empire Software, available for PC, Xbox, and PlayStation 2. We'll do a follow-up in Bits and Bytes next month, hopefully, on the PS2 version. Let's take a few minutes to talk about the GP2X. I promised you guys some good juicy details this month, and while I have not yet received my unit to give you a proper review, I did want to take the time, keep my word, and give you guys some nice juicy insight as to what's going on with what I'm hoping will be the future emulation handheld for everybody. Just a quick recap, what is the GP2X? It's a dual processor, 200 megahertz ARM-based handheld. Imagine a PlayStation Portable. Imagine a Sony PSP without all the locks on it, without the firmware revisions, without the stifling against homebrew. A nice big screen, non-touch screen, but nice clean screen, plays all your media, including stuff like DivX and Xvid, all the stuff that the PlayStation Portable doesn't play unless you convert it first. Imagine that. Imagine a machine made by people who created, at least in part, the GP32, the GamePark 32, which is, of course, the most popular of the quirky home emulation portables. The GP32, I've almost had to buy one. Of course, they're only importable, so it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, you got to be really sure if that's what you want. But the GP32 has managed to, hands down, stomp every other handheld out in terms of what sort of things you can do with it. the openness of the hardware and the architecture, using standard memory, using standard batteries, playing tons and tons of arcade and video game emulation, console emulation. The GP32 has been the ultimate emulation home hacker toolkit. Well, in the same vein as that, the GP2X is the big brother of the GP32. Loaded up with features, loaded up with power. The power to pretty much do anything us old school emulation people want to do. The 2x200 megahertz processor should give us plenty of power to do what we need. It's got 64 megs of onboard RAM, uses standard SD cards, uses standard AA batteries with a 6 to 8 hour playback time. Can't touch that on the PlayStation Portable, right? Let's see, what else can I tell you about it? Plays all sorts of media type formats based on a Linux operating system. Totally free and open source time development. In fact, they even give you the SDK, which means you can make games yourself right from what you get in the box. That's great stuff. Price runs about $180, which is still cheaper than a PlayStation Portable, right? I will tell you this, though. This is not the sort of thing you want to look at if you're looking for like commercial games like Burnout, things like that. Don't see the GP2X becoming the next big commercial sensation. No offense, that's just the way I see it. But I do see this having a complete, huge wave ripple through the emulation community. Now, the GP2X we've been told was going to ship in October. However, it's November tomorrow, and ain't going to ship by tomorrow. However, Craig, my contact over at GP2X, was kind enough to keep me in the loop this whole time to let me know what's going on. The firmware of the unit is now gold. The factories are manufacturing and shipping. So if you purchased it directly from them, you'll probably get it a bit sooner than if you purchased it, say, through a third-party vendor. I suspect that we'll start seeing them the middle of November, which is perfect. I need something to take over with me to my mother-in-law's house at Thanksgiving time. Not that I don't have my Nintendo DS, but I'd like to have a new toy to play with, too. Some of the other features of this guy, before I get all segued into some of the little juicy bits of gossip I've got here, before I get segued into that, I'd like to give you a couple of other ideas as to what this thing can do. Biggest thing that I want to mention is TV out. Now, that's not anything new and revolutionary, but what's really nice is this thing will upscale up to the highest resolution. Was it 740 by 480, something like that? The kind of stuff that you'd expect to see. So you could drop, let's say you go and encode your favorite movie in XVIII. A lot of people are doing that now. White boxes are getting more popular. People have movies on their PC hooked up to their TV. It's a standard deal. So chances are likely you already have movies and TV shows already encoded in this 720 by 480 or, you know, 512 by 385 or whatever these weird, some of these weird resolutions are that XVID comes up with. But you've already got media. You know, just like I bitch about the PlayStation Portable, I've got DVDs already. I've got a mass abundance of them. I do not want to rebuy these things. I do not want to spend 4.5 hours converting a DVD or converting my existing media files to some weird proprietary format. Even if it's MPEG-4, I don't have anything in MPEG-4. My stuff's not going to play. You know what I'm saying? I want something that I can use as a Twitch device. Twitch means I can just grab it and go. You don't grab it and go when you have to wait 5 hours for video to convert. So this is nice because I can throw the video directly on an SD card, like in no time, throw it in the machine, and it'll play back on its regular screen, scaled down using a hardware scaler. I don't have a lot of details on that. Or you can TV out it, and it will run at its original resolution. No conversion. Now, I'm not a big portable media kind of guy, as you know. I'm a portable gaming kind of guy. But in this case, if they can do emulation and video, and they can do them both well, I'm down with that. What I'm not down with is when one thing suffers over another. Now, if you could only play those 780 by 480 videos or 740 by 480 videos on that little screen, then that would be one thing. But being able to TV out and view it in all its glory, no brainer. Am I right or am I right? Right. So, anyway, let's talk about some of the good, juicy things that are going on behind the stages at GP2X, not 32. At GP2X, first and foremost, you guys know what I'm into for emulation. Commodore 64, Commodore Amiga, and MAME, basically. Those are the things that I've got to have. Now, you'll also probably have heard that I'm big into Duke Nukem 3D. That, to me, was the pinnacle of 3D gaming. That was what I spent all my time on. That is where my love was, etc., etc. Good stuff. Now, MAME, of course, has got a decent port to the GP32. You'll find me comparing these a lot because the same people that are behind the GP32 in terms of development are going to get behind the GP2X. So if it exists on the GP32 and it's good, it can only be better on the GP2X. So MAME has got a port. We're going to get MAME. And they're definitely talking about it being no problem to run big ROMs like Neo Geo. Not that I care, but a lot of you do. Being able to run those big fatty ROMs because of the onboard memory. So that's a great thing. That's wonderful. That's progress. I've also been told that they have Duke Nukem 3D running on this guy. Now, this has no built-in wireless networking. That's not to say that you couldn't plug something into the USB port and make it work. I'm saying there's nothing built in, which is one of the few little minor slams against it. But that's okay. A lot of people don't care about that, as long as they get a good solo experience. That's great. No problems with that, but it's worth mentioning. So we got Duke 3D running. Apparently they have a version of DOSBox implemented, which means a lot of the stuff that I grew up with when I moved to PC that I grew up with, things like Night Trap, I'm willing to bet that you'll be able to mount disk images. In that case, I could run Night Trap on DOSBox. There's a lot of great DOS games, folks. I mean, I hate to say it. Of course, a lot of them came from the Amiga days, but whatever. There's a lot of good DOS style games that would be really nice if you could break out and dust off the box and break them out and start playing some of this stuff, right? The Night Trap, the Hyper 3D Pinball. I got tons of this old DOS stuff laying around that I'd love to be able to play again. This will probably make it possible. They've got Quake running on it at good speeds. What else can I tell you? Commodore 64 emulation was already excellent on the GP32. I expect it to be excellent or better on the GP2X. Now, Amiga emulation is always something that's tough. I mean, let's be honest. Even a nice, powerful PC's got problems kicking out Amiga titles right now. Some of the harder more CPU intensive stuff, demos, 3D type stuff, whatever. So, as I understand it, they are giving the Amiga special attention. Seems the old GP2X guys are big Amiga fans. If you go through their site, which I'll give you a link to, you'll find that these guys are real big supporters of the Amiga. So it makes very much sense to find out that they are working on a dedicated assembly-based core for Amiga emulation. And that can only mean that we're going to at least get A500, you know, the A500 1 megabyte, 1 mega chip RAM environment perfect. As long as I've got that, I can play a bunch of stuff. There's also hints based on what I've been told that we're going to get AGA emulation, which means we can finally play Banshee and Chaos Engine, AGA, and all that other good stuff that actually was worthwhile in the AGA architecture. So, lots of good stuff coming up. And Craig has been very good to me, keeping in touch with me, letting me know what's going on. You know, this guy's got to get a billion emails a day. And yet he's good enough to keep things up with me, which is really, really impressive. And I do appreciate it a lot. Let's see if I've got anything else from Craig that really, really stands out that I should be telling you about. Yeah, doesn't look like it. I got so much more I want to talk about with the GP2X, but I want to get a unit in my hand first so I can really give you guys the straight skinny, because I'm not going to mince words on this. You're going to know whether it rocks or not, and I'll be the one to tell you. So I'm even expecting us to see things like Game Boy Advance emulation on here. I can totally see it happening. Really, that would be truly cool to be able to pack all my GBA stuff on there, because I got plenty of good titles that I could play on that. In any event, I'll try to give you some more links. I've got links to movies with the GP2X in action, playing videos, showing off some other stuff. I will, of course, keep you up to date. If you really want to get the like full skinny scoop, keep an eye on the message forums, because that's where we post a lot about what's going on with the GP2X. And, of course, next month, I'm hoping, I'll hold the show till the end of November. Well, like I'm not going to do that anyway, right? I will hold the show in order to get a good review of the GP2X and make sure that I give you guys the straight skinny. Because you know how it is, importing something, you're always worried about quality, you're worried about whether you're going to get the product in a timely manner. I'll give you some recommended distribution channels to get the title, the unit from and the titles from. So we're going to give you the full skinny next month. But I did want to tell you about the real exciting stuff, the Amiga Core, ASM Core that they're working on, Duke Nukem 3D, which I'm totally stoked out of my mind to be able to play again. There's just tons of good stuff, and we're going to get it all worked out for you next month. But here's anyway, this is your teaser, GP2X at gp2x.co.uk. I'm also working on my own GP2X advocacy site at gp2x.us. Imagine that, a U.S. address. Funky. Right now I've got the basic GP2X versus the PlayStation Portable, where you can walk down and see the numbers. I've got lots of people arguing about this and that and that and this, and this is not accurate, but I'm working on trying to get it as accurate as possible to make sure that people can make an informed decision. So, GP2X, good stuff. We'll have a full review, hopefully, for you next month. Last month we brought you Jerry Lawson, the great engineering mind behind the Fairchild Channel F, and surprisingly, the granddaddy of almost all the sort of things that you find in modern video game systems. Brilliant storyteller, excellent interview, really needs no introduction. This is part two of the Jerry Lawson interview from the Classic Gaming Expo 2005. Enjoy.
A lot of the people thought of hand controllers as being POTS.
Right.
Which were A to D converters. What we did with that hand control in software, again, we viewed software as the major input and versatility of the system.
Right.
So we even came up with a concept that we actually simulated. It was almost like a pot. In other words, when you made the contact, it didn't just drive it to the next point. It drove it in a different speed function depending on how long you made the contact.
Right.
Okay. So it was like coarse and fine, like you would find in working with a regular control. So there was a lot of things that we put into the microprocessor. And the point is that I was always a believer that if you have got a microprocessor in a machine, it's criminal not to explore all the ways that software can help.
That makes good sense.
Yeah. See, a lot of people went, oh, yeah, just wait for, no, no. It does things that you can't do any other way.
So it's like one of those Swedish massage girls that you can get to rub your back, but she does other things.
Yes.
Yeah.
There you go.
There you go.
If she's going to be rubbing your back, she might as well do the rest. Yeah, right?
Wait, that's right. I might flip over. We'll take care of that.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so now let's talk about the software, right?
Okay.
That's the real thing that makes a machine run.
Okay.
Hardware's brilliant. You got that all taken care of. Let's talk about the software. Mm-hmm. How many games came out for the Fairchild, roughly?
About 27.
27.
And with some that never came out.
Like what? Do you remember off the top of your head?
Well, there's one I brought out later back in mind. one of the things I tried to do is that I made a deliberate study on trying to make a family-oriented game. Now, what I mean by family-oriented game is that it's easy to make games that excite kids.
Sure.
Okay? But to have a kid play an adult, very difficult.
Right.
Because kids have a built-in eye-hand coordination that will whip an adult to death.
Right.
You can't match them. Okay? And I was out to try to get a way of matching them both together, where grown-ups could play children.
Gotcha. Okay?
Now, it's important to me to investigate that area, because one of the things we found is, like, we had a game that was called Maze. And we found that kids could beat the hell out of you in doing a maze game. Because what we found out, and I did some studies, kids don't see a maze like an adult sees it.
Right.
An adult sees a maze and he looks and sees, up this way, down that way, up this way, down that way, up this way, down. And finally, eventually, gets to the output. Kids see the maze and they see input, output. Okay?
All right.
Now, out. Because they don't see the intricacies of each little detail.
Right.
Adults are fooled by their own experience. They look at something and say, this is complex. Let me see here. How do I do this? Kids don't bother to find that past information is stopping
right.
them from working it. See, we are slow as adults because we are trained to take on problems a different way. A kid doesn't, he's got a clean slate back there. He doesn't have pre-information to prejudice him how to do something.
Right.
We found that very key. Now, we found there was an area of games that adults could play children. And those games were games that required memorization.
Hmm.
Adults started to take on a play to start to equal kids. We found concentration was good. We found Whizball, one of the games we did Whizball, was that what we did was we had squares that ran around that had numerical value.
Right.
And your deal was to get over it and find that one, find its value, then track it in your mind to find the match to it. Okay? Or to find a way to put them in order. Like, this is number one, where's number two? We found that adults and kids started to get equal in that game. But if you give them any kind of game that was ball and paddle, you did. The old folks can't do it. Okay?
So what sort of cartridge construction? What was in a cartridge of a Fairchild Channel F game? What's in there?
There is a thing which is called the PSU, Program Storage Unit. It's not simply a ROM, a read-only memory.
Right.
It's different. See, the F8 had... they had chips that you can line together that would include an extension of ROM, but each time you got a PSU, you got 16 bits of I.O. Oh, there they are. Yeah, okay.
I want to see.
Yeah, these are prototype cartridges. And where they're prototype cartridges, they are standard everyday ROMs, EPROMs.
Right.
Okay? But inside here is a part which was called the 3853, which was a part that stayed on the bus like other FA chips. But the output of it was to go to a standard ROM and address the standard ROM.
Right.
A regular PSU unit only had I.O. ports and it had no addressing the outside ROM.
Right.
So the PSU was a problem because it was manufactured in masking. You only could make that at time of code. In other words, you couldn't say it could only be made in mass production. Okay?
Right.
So there was no way to do it. I mean, you had to have the code all precise, set it out, submit it in, have the mask made to make that PSU part that was your arm. So as a result, you could not prototype it that way. You had to have another prototyping element. So if I wanted to try a game, this is the way I would prototype the element.
Interesting.
Okay.
Very interesting.
And the chips themselves, well, we were the first ones to also do a feature which was called COB, chip on board. Chip on a board. What we did was the chips themselves, instead of putting them in a package, we put them on the board. And we would bond them to the board. Okay?
Yeah.
And then put a small plastic cap to protect the circuit on the board. And that was the cheapest way we could make a board.
Hmm.
And it was a concept that later on, people say, oh, we invented chip on board. We said, we've been doing it in 1975. What are you talking about, huh?
When were you doing it?
Yeah, what were you doing? It's amazing. I get such a kick out of all these people that stand up and say they did it first. And I go, oh.
That sounds like you pretty much did everything first.
Not really.
A lot of
because,
things.
No, because I made some things that were first, but I couldn't even take credit because I didn't really know they were first.
Right.
I wouldn't go out to make them. I'm first.
Right.
I didn't go out with that attitude. And there were other people that contributed too. I can't take credit for that.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
So, when did the Fairchild went on sale? What about 76 or right in
76,
there?
76. Yeah.
Yeah. And what was the outlet? I mean, let's be honest. I mean, there was no Toys R Us, right? Where were these things sold? Where did somebody walk in and get one of these guys?
The first companies that wanted to sell them and demanded to have exclusivity was...
Oh, demanded?
Demanded.
What's that all about?
Oh, well, we had... Who's the big chain in Texas? No, Bloomingdale's one of them, but this was Neiman Marcus.
Really? How about that?
Neiman Marcus said they only wanted to sell that, and they didn't want anybody else to sell it the first year.
Interesting.
Well, because Neiman Marcus considered it such a rare, brand new thing,
right,
that they wanted to be exclusive with it. And Neiman Marcus doesn't like everybody running the Payless store and find the same thing.
Yeah.
And at one time, we weren't smart enough, as far as our marketing concept,
right,
to sell it. Well, let's sell it in Neiman Marcus first because we can't make enough. And then next year, we'll go to the other chain. Okay? And we sold it. Neiman Marcus, Bloomingdale's had it. Fortunoff's another chain. A&S in Brooklyn had it. That one's an interesting one. In fact, I had an incident that happened where Bloomingdale's asked me, I was in town, and they asked me really to come by and take a look at how they were showing it. And they had all kind of comments to make about things. So. But like I said, I wasn't in marketing to do that.
Right.
And I ended up with marketing toward the end.
I bet.
Well, because marketing couldn't give me inputs on what games to do.
Right.
And I said, well, look, you guys can't tell me what games to make. Then I'm going to do it, okay?
Get back in your hole.
Yeah, please. And, like, we made... then they were getting nasty. Like, one time, they did a bowling game. And they said, we want a beer frame.
A what
so you
frame?
You want a what? A beer frame. We gotta have a beer frame.
What's a beer frame?
Damn if I knew.
You didn't find out?
Yeah. Didn't want to. You know what I told him? What? Ain't got no room in the cartridge. Well, you have the beer frame. You tell me where to put it. Then I had beer an incident frame. One time that I had a game that was too small. And the chairman of the board called me to a meeting and said, hey, Jerry. Yes, sir? I understand you killed Torpedo Alley. I said, yeah. I liked it. Well, you're the only one.
Yeah.
hey, Jerry, you don't have to have every game be a brain game. I go, that's not the point. So what? It was too small to go on the cartridges and take the space up.
Right.
So it didn't make economic sense. Because when we find something else that we can stick it with, okay, I'll do it. And that's what happened. I did find something else to stick it with. But the point was, I didn't do it because you thought it was good.
Yeah.
In fact, I had another interesting thing that happened was the marketing guys were getting a little bit PO'd. I had a guy who was, he kind of looked like Howdy Doody.
Did you tell him that?
Yeah. He came with a marketing plan, and I read the plan, and I go, I'm looking at these games that he came up with. Where did you come with these games?
His kids tell him.
He said, it's all the rage in the Dallas airport. I said, what? Yeah, these are the games they're playing in the Dallas airport. I said, you can take a wooden Indian and put a slot in his nose and put a quarter in and his headdress lights up and it would make money in the Dallas airport. I said, what kind of criteria is this for playing a game? So I took his business plan and all the games and I threw it in the trash right in front of him.
Nice.
So then I said, you know, the guys that originally did blackjack on the F8, I called them. Hey, guys, how would you like to take the blackjack you made for the system and that would have played on an ASR-33 and make it into a game? Hey, cool. I'll pay you under the table. Right? Cool. They made it. Excellent job. They did a green felt table, had the cards all dealt out. I got the game, the prototype. I sent it to the big man. My boss was coming down with a hatchet to pay it in my head because he found out what I had done with the marketing plan. And it was timed beautifully. He walked into my office ready to go something, and the phone rang. And it was the chairman of the board of the company. Jerry, I just finished playing blackjack. What? You can shove all the other games away. Let's make blackjack games. That's it.
That's it.
That's it. We got it. This is it. The greatest thing I ever did was play this blackjack game. He said, where's Greg? Standing right here.
Oh.
He said, put him on the phone. I said, okay. The boss man want to talk to you. And he said, uh-huh. Oh, you liked it, huh? Yeah, oh, great, huh?
Good.
Good. I'm right. And he looks at me and said, nice timing, Lawson.
You set that up.
And he said, give me the phone back, right? From then on, I made anything I wanted to make. And the concurrence was the guys looked at the software programmers we all got together and said, what's this worth? That's that worth.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, having somebody who was in marketing tell us that didn't know what he was doing.
Right.
But I got one of the other funniest things is that I don't want to draw this into an R-rated show. But
oh, no, you feel free. Jump right in here.
Well, when we did Blackjack, one of the guys in the company, pretty far up in the command structure, he said there was a symbol that S, start, would meant start the game.
Right.
And there was another word that would come out was said hit. He was playing the game and he kept doing something stupid like hitting when he shouldn't have hit. Well, what happened, and this is just some pure accident, it came up with the hit and put the S in front of him. And he swore I did it.
Right.
He called me up and said, Lawson, you should see what this darn game said. I said, what? I kept doing something stupid, but they came back and they got mad at me. That's you. I go, no, man. Swear out I did that. That I tricked it up and put that in it. Okay? And the other thing that was funny was that we had a tic-tac-toe game.
Yeah.
Well, in the tic-tac-toe game, it said, one of the programmers originally wrote it, knew that my favorite word was turkey.
Turkey.
Yeah. But I thought you were an idiot. I called you a turkey.
Right? Gotcha.
And he put in there, you lose turkey. And
nice.
I saw it and I said, that's cute. So they said, you want to take it out?
That's in.
It stays. You lose turkey.
That's right? Great. Yeah. So how long did the Fairchild run? I mean, how many years did you guys manage to pump that guy out?
About 2 years, 3 years.
There was like 3 or 4 versions, right?
There was 2 versions, 2 main versions.
And different locations in the country got a different 2 version, right? Or just
no,
different names?
No. The reason why we had the first version was the first version had SSI logic chips in it.
Gotcha.
That's the one that we got through the marketplace as fast as possible. When we were able to make an LSI equivalent of it, we made the next version, but because we didn't change the case, it still had the same size board in it.
Gotcha.
But it had like 2 large LSI chips on it with all this darn space. And the only reason I did it like that was to maintain that we could still use those cases. So we just changed the board for the next production.
Right.
Then because we wanted to save as much money as it was, we had to have a new case. So the new case incorporated the smaller board. It also incorporated an RF modulator that had sound.
Yeah.
See, when the original ones, the sound was internal to the system.
Right.
Not on the air.
Right.
Not in the RF unit. And it was the last model that we had, which was we added the FM capability so that you could add sound
to
the TV.
Right.
So that was different. Yeah.
So after Fairchild was done and over with, late 70s, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where'd you move on to next?
Well, for about 2 years, I went into hiding in Fairchild. I was given a job with one of the other divisions, and I was asked to look over my people. And
Were they paying you pretty good bank for that Fairchild?
Not really.
No? Wasn't extraordinary? Wasn't like these Atari stories you hear where they were giving them Porsches and naked chicks and stuff?
No.
Nothing like that?
No.
No, that's too bad. You pioneered this stuff and you didn't even get the good stuff.
No, didn't.
Downer,
yeah. You got that right.
Yeah, sorry about that. I was just curious.
Too bad, yeah. No, in fact, what happened was my people were given to Fairchild Systems and I was told to go with them. And they no longer worked for me. I was the chief engineer without a staff.
Gotcha.
And I said, well, what do you want me to do? So, well, we want you to make sure your people can integrate into our group. And if they have any problems, we want you to watch out for them, talk to them, that kind of thing.
Right.
And what used to happen was I used to be in the cafeteria, and all my people used to come to me and sit with me. Okay? And one of the bosses says, what kind of loyalty do you have? Well, I said, what do you mean? He says, you're still the boss. And so I don't demand their special. These guys were individuals, and I treated them like that.
Yeah.
Okay? And they were good guys. I mean, in fact, one time, I'll get the funniest deal was we had a problem sometimes getting parts for doing our own research and development. So I had a guy who was the equivalent of radar in MASH. Okay?
Yeah.
He could get you anything. And one day, the foreman on the production line gets blown out that he says to me, your guy is stealing off my production line. I want him fired. Oh, you want him fired? Absolutely. I'm not going to tolerate him taking any more stuff from us. And he was taking stuff that we needed. We couldn't get it from anybody else. All right? So I called him and said, Mike, get in here now. All right? And Mike comes over and the foreman's sitting there and he walks in. Get your ass in my office right now, right? And I slammed the door and the foreman goes out. All right. And I said, Mike, what? How dare you? I said, you stupid SOB? What? Don't you ever get caught again.
Yeah.
Embarrass me. I said, I send you out there, make sure you do a good job. Still don't get caught.
Oh, man. So when did you take up with the Amiga stuff?
Well, I left Fairchild to... Let me give you the whole story.
Let's finish that story. Yeah. I didn't mean to jump too far ahead.
A company by the name of Activision. I guess you've heard of them. Activision was being sued by Atari.
Right.
The story was that former employees of Atari left to go to Activision.
Right.
And Atari said they stole trade secrets in order to program 2600 cartridges. Well, the Activision people sought me out through their legal staff.
Wow.
And said, hey, what we did was we reverse engineered it. And we're saying that Atari's wrong. That's okay. Lawson, we want you to do the same thing, reverse engineer the 2600 and come up with an instruction manual on how to program it.
That's cool.
I said, okay. We'll pay you. Okay.
That's even more cool.
I said, hey, it's cool.
Yeah, throw me some money.
So I did it. And when I did it, Activision claimed it took them 2 months or 3 months to do it. I did it in a month.
Nice.
So right away, a deposition comes. We want Lawson in here, right? So I get called in for a deposition. Well, one of the things that happened during the deposition, they had these wonderful Harvard lawyers, and I said, they asked me, well, how did you know it was the 6502 processor? Everybody knows that. It's common knowledge.
Right.
And said, I said, I bet you got some PhD trying to figure it out now from MIT. So what the heck am I going to do the hard way if I know what it is? That's silly. All right. So took the logic analyzer, went through the command instructions, found out what they were. Okay? Wrote a manual. Well, during the deposition, during one of the breaks, I said to the lawyers at Atari, I said, you know, you guys ain't too bright. I said, a technician can do this. Okay? I said, you're going to look funny when this thing gets to court. No big deal doing this. I said, if I was you, I'd just drop it. So the lawyers there that I was working for kind of loved that, right? And Atari did drop it.
Wow.
So, but then I said, okay. I said to them, I said, what am I going to do with this stupid manual? And he said, we're afraid we're going to ask that. I said, why? He said, well, you ain't the only one. Well, how many people did you get? 3 groups of guys.
Wow.
Oh, okay. And each one of them's got a manual. So what's with the manual? Well, we claim that reverse engineering is public domain. So therefore, the guys that publicly reversed it, it's their information, they can do what they want to do with it. Oh, I see. Okay. Well, one guy was selling it for $10,000 a copy.
Oh, man. Don't have eBay back then.
No.
That's too bad. You can make a mint.
Yeah, they were selling it for 10 grand a copy.
Wow.
And everybody and his brother wanted that book.
Tell me you made fat bank selling yours.
Uh-uh.
Oh, uh-uh. Look at you.
No. I used the manual and the information to start a business. So it wasn't a point of, you know the secrets of how you program the Atari game. And that was it.
And that's when VideoSoft came about, huh?
Yeah.
So you guys were getting in the 2600 business.
Mm-hmm.
And what did you guys release under that name?
We released a couple of cartridges that we did for other people. Nothing under our own name. We did something for... Oh, that one, yeah. I forgot about that.
Wow. Let me see. I guess
right.
See what you got.
That's one.
Color bar generator.
Yeah.
Nice. Not much of a game, but I'm sure a very useful cartridge for developers.
No, well, the way that hack came about, and that's 3D Ghost.
Oh, cool.
It's the first 3D cartridge. Three-dimensional with red and blue glasses.
Oh, really? How cool is that?
We played it the other day.
Is it a good game?
Well, the way that Calabar one came out, Dan McElroy had done it, and we got down, sat down and done it. And I said, well, you know, we could sell this thing. And they said, nah. At the time at VideoSell, my chief engineer, a guy by the name of Steve Young, said, no way. Nobody's going to buy this thing. And I said, yeah, they will. They can buy it to adjust TV set.
Right.
And she said, yeah, adjust them for color, convergence. In those days, it was an important factor.
Yeah.
And he said, nah, I don't think so. Well, I do think so. And the way I said, well, I'd like to get advertising, but I'm not going to sit here and play so much money on this for advertising. How can I get advertising for free? And I said, okay. I contacted Radio Electronics and told them I'd had an article for them, how to make a color bar generator with a cartridge for Atari game. They went, oh, okay. I got the front page.
Wow.
And I got paid for it.
Oh, yeah.
And what I did was I made it a kit. Said, here's the PC board. Here's the code. Buy the EEPROM. Make the deal. Buy the listing for $9.95. Program the part. Have a ball.
Wow.
Okay? Up until, I guess, 10 years ago, I was still getting orders for it.
My God, really? Wow.
Yeah, I was getting orders for it. I get orders from all over the world for it.
Wow.
But there's some unique things. That, in fact, what's so funny was I was really surprised that I wrote the article kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing. Like, it was a joke.
Yeah.
They kept it that way.
Cool.
So you say you're tired of doing this. You say you don't got an attitude, you know? And they did it. They took it that way. They loved it. The only thing they did wrong was they flopped the color picture. I don't know why they did that, but they flopped it. But it was interesting.
That's not your fault.
Yeah, but I mean, I got a kick out of back Dave here.
We slid out when you weren't looking.
Oh, he wasn't looking. Dave was at a swap meet about a month ago. And he comes up to me and says, you won't believe what I found. I said, what? He hands me the magazine.
Nice.
And I said, oh, my God. He said, what? Good Lord. Did you buy it? He said, yeah, thank you. What? Because I ain't got one.
Oh, you never had one?
I had one. I just lost it. I don't know where it went.
Oh, man.
So Dave said, here it is. So the wife made sure this time we took it and had it copied and laminated so we won't never lose it again.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, that was really interesting. But like I said, the other thing we did is we had a cartridge system that we were trying to manufacture. What the cartridge system did was I see that the problem with video games is that when you make regular cartridges,
yeah,
if they don't sell in certain areas, you got a logistics problem. You got too many of these, not enough of these, that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So how do you do that? Well, you make them on tape. And in the tape machine, the tape would play. In fact, the way the unit was made is that it had a mechanism, which was a curve, that went into the 2600, and it had a tape recorder sat on the top of it. And you put the tape in it, all right, and it got its power from the 2600.
Wow.
Okay. And one of the other things it did, which was cute, was that in the side, it had an audio jack that you could feed to the phone so you could play games over the phone.
Wow.
So we're going to have a whole series of games, 2600, that you can play intercollegiate games with each other. Okay. And that system, we had it manufactured. We're going to have it manufactured in Ankara. For a very short time, we were also, VideoSoft was also connected for a while. Hasbro wanted to buy us out.
Wow.
And that fell through. And we just said, the heck with it.
You're so a rich man probably with that.
Yeah, so we ended up, I met Moss. And Moss was the president of Amiga.
Oh.
And Moss was impressed with my company and said, hey, you know, you wanted to buy me. I said, no, man, I don't want to do this. But you guys can do our software. Nah. I started this company. I don't want to just go from that to go work with somebody again.
Yeah.
You know? So he said, I'll tell you what, how about if you do contract work for us? I said, okay. So the first thing we did was we did a bunch of 2600 things for them. And they were like, we had a ski game, Surf's Up, another game we made. I was wondering, have you guys ever seen Surf's Up? Amiga did it?
I don't think so.
They had a panel with it, stand on, and make like with a surfboard.
Is that like is that the same panel they used for the Guru Meditation game?
I don't know that game.
No.
But that was a surfboard game, and we did all the software for it. But cool. They introduced it for the 2600, not for the Amiga.
Right.
In the meantime, they were feverishly working on bringing in the Amiga. And, like, I used to get a kick out of the fact that, you remember who Mitzi was?
Mitzi. Oh, this sounds really familiar.
The guy who was the genius of the hardware.
Right.
And building the chip was a guy by the name of Jay Miner.
Jay Miner. Yeah. Died recently.
Not that recently. Well, years back.
I guess it's been a little while,
I hope so, because I was at his funeral. Well, anyhow, Jay Miner was also the guy that did the 2600 Stella chip.
Right, I knew that actually, believe it or not. Yeah.
Jay Miner did the Amiga game chips, and when they built the system, his dog, who had a badge and worked in a company, had his paw print on the plastic mold and his name signed on it. So if you find one of the old 1000 Amigas and open it up, you'll see a dog's paw print in it.
The signature editions with all the developers' names, the dog's on there too?
Dog's on there too.
I didn't know about that.
Yes.
A friend of mine had one. I never saw the dog print though.
Yeah, the dog's in there. If you take a look and you'll find a print and you'll find a dog in there. And one of the things that was very funny was that Jay used to come by my place with VideoSoft quite often. We'd go to lunch, talk. And I had a picture in my lobby, and that picture was of the 2600 chip. Now, when Mattel hired me to do the reverse engineering to build it, one of the first things you do is you take the plastic chip and you dissolve it in nitric acid to clean off the plastic. Then you have a photograph made in color to look at the chip. Well, the chip is, the picture I had was about this big, square. And I figure at $1,000, that qualifies as art.
Yeah.
Okay.
You pay a grand, that's art.
Yeah, that's art.
Absolutely. I'd have that on
I
my
framed
wall.
It.
Yeah. You still have it?
No. Is it? Jay used to come in and see it and kind of look at it, kind of liked it, but he never realized it was his chip.
Oh, man.
And when I turned down my business and went out, I took the thing over to Jay at Amiga. And I said, you've always admired this. Here it is, yours. He said, yeah, thank you. So Jay, look in the corner. And when Jay said, oh my God, it's a Stella chip. He said, you recognized it but didn't recognize it. You used to come through and see it and do a double take. And I used to crack up because he said, he never caught on, it was his chip.
Wow.
And he said, oh my God, well, thank you. And he said, and he took it home. That was his contribution to have.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's
he was,
way
he
cool.
was a good dude.
He sounds like a really cool guy.
He was.
I'm sad I never got to meet him.
He was very cool. He was, he kind of was, he looked, I guess, have you ever seen him?
Yeah, I've seen his picture in the later days, yeah.
He kind of looked like Santa Claus.
He did? Yeah. Or if you would, if you'd put like a black leather thing on him, he looked like a biker.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you could tie his hair back and, you know, put the chaps on.
And you should have seen the car he had.
Oh,
he bought a, I'm trying to think what the heck they call that thing. It looked like it was a sports car looking thing.
Yeah.
But it had a power guide transmission and a Chevy engine. And I think it cost a half a fortune. and he used to drive that thing, and it looked like a Stutz Bearcat.
Huh.
A real sports car with the wheel in the back, you know, and the air hoses in the side and all that. And the dog sat in the passenger seat.
Oh, you love that dog.
Oh, and that dog, and if you try to sit down, the dog goes, you know. The only way I would go with him with Mitzi was I have to take Mitzi and say, okay, Mitzi, sit in my lap. All right? He loved that dog. He had two other dogs. One dog was just an absolute mutt from the street. The dog was a diabetic. And he used to give the dog daily insulin shots.
Yeah.
But he was that kind of a guy. He was
yeah.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
So what else did you do actually any games that actually were on an Amiga?
No, we didn't run.
Just,
no,
just
not that
ski,
time.
Just
no, that's the 2600 stuff. We didn't do anything on it.
So what happened to you after that? Video stopped. You said it folded or went under?
It died, went under. And I ended up going back into the semiconductor world as a... I was training guys, and I was like Mr. Teacher.
Yeah.
I worked for Signetics microprocessor division. I also helped run their Feelapps guys.
That's cool. So do you still game? I mean, do you play games now?
You know, I'm not much of a game player. Because my first of all, what has happened over the years is that diabetes has taken its kind of toll on me. I only have one eye.
Right.
In fact, I can't even see the 3D in the other eye. Thing. I'm just diabetes got me in my leg and my eye. In fact, right leg, right eye. Then I got a stroke in the right hand, so the doctor said, "Okay, now you're lefty."
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, again, like I said, you got to keep coming on. Keep going. And I still work on novel things I'm working on, books and other ideas, like other product ideas I work on.
Yeah?
I once had I did a subliminal machine.
Nice. Did you get, like, lots of chicks from that, or?
No, I didn't get no chicks
from that.
My wife wouldn't let me have it.
Oh, that's a little too late.
No, yeah.
You can't develop subliminal machines when you're married.
Yeah,
you
got to
do that stuff before you have the wife.
The wife didn't like that.
No, I bet.
I know.
I don't know, though. You can still find that useful.
Well, what it was, it's very funny. You know of a guy named Ron Popeil?
You
never heard of Ron Popeil?
Yeah. I may
it
have.
It dices. It's the microphone.
Oh, the Ronco stuff.
Ronco.
Yeah, Ronco, okay.
The rotisserie.
Yeah, guy that started that scene on TV.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Spray your head and take away your baldness. Yeah, that guy.
Oh, man.
He came to me, wanted to develop some kind of subliminal machine.
Oh, man.
And I dude it. Made it cheap enough that it worked. And then he ran around telling everybody that it was really funny. I had a tape that said, "Stop smoking."
Right.
I used to smoke about 3 packs a day. I decided not to smoke, not because of this machine, I just decided not to smoke.
Yeah.
He told everybody, even the inventor used it to stop smoking.
Oh, man. Thanks, buddy. Wow.
No,
did you make a lot of cash out of that subliminal machine?
Nah.
Nah?
Nah.
More money
with
the hair spray.
The rainbow always keeps going out. No, I didn't do that one either. I don't see him. Or Mr. Microphone or the fisherman.
I think I have Mr. Microphone. That sucks.
Oh, boy. You know, it's like I said, it's timing.
Oh, yeah. Everything's about timing.
It is timing. Like, for instance, 6 up.
6 up.
You familiar with that?
Yeah.
The next guy, 7 up. Big hit.
Oh, man. Oh. Oh, man, this has been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
What's
that?
Pal?
TV Pal?
What am I missing out on? Tell me about the TV Pal.
Okay.
I feel like I'm missing out on something.
Okay. TV Pal, a guy by the name of Marv Kempner, contacted me in the 78 timing around there that he wanted to do local television. There's a dead time.
Right.
And that dead time is like around noon to about 4. You can't give TV away.
Right.
Because people don't watch it. They watch the soaps.
Yeah.
On the networks. But local TV didn't have a draw. So what they used to do is they used to show maybe movies. Okay? But the movie wasn't good enough. They wanted to draw you in to have you watch. So the way you prove that they're watching is you give them an audience participation show.
Right.
That they have to physically call in and know that they're looking. And one of the ones they first did was called Dialing for Dollars.
Right. Yeah, Dialing for Dollars. Sure.
Okay. And what they used to give you was a count and amount. They call somebody, what's the count and the amount? And they did, they won bing, bing, bing money, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Marv Kempner came out with this idea of having a video game played. Okay? And we developed the hardware that what he needed done was to be able to have the guy on the phone do something like shout, hey, or how, and operate the video game. So what we did was, first thing we did was to make the game have a video output rather than an RF, so that they could plug it into their distribution center as a camera, like a camera input, and feed it to the transmitter.
Right.
And they could switch it in and out with a technical director to sit there and go, okay, and when they switch from a shot to the guy to the game.
Right.
So that was one thing we did. Then he wanted to be able to have the guy on the phone, on the TV line, on the audio, but they wanted the announcer not to be able to trip the game.
Okay, gotcha. And
so we had to build a hybrid device, and the hybrid device is something that's used on phones that allows one side of the conversation to be attenuated from the other.
Right.
And that's what we did. So it would allow somebody on the phone to go, hey, ow, boom, make a noise, any kind of noise, and we could activate that, whereas the announcer wouldn't.
Interesting.
And the box had a function that it would act like a hand controller, like the button pushing down, and the hand controller. And we would activate, the game was called Shooting Gallery. And what it would do is it would start the game, and the Shooting Gallery would run with this so-called duck flying back, up and down. And you had to sit there and time it and go bang or pow to shoot a projector over to hit the duck.
Wow.
Okay?
Interactive TV.
Well, it was 1978. Yeah.
Wow.
And it ran here locally on Channel 2. It ran on a bunch of different stations. In fact, the first time it was demoed was Regis Philbin demoed it.
No kidding.
Yes, on TV.
And he's older than I thought.
He's a lot older than you thought.
Yeah. Did that answer your question? I feel bad. I didn't even hear of it.
No.
I have. Well, Jerry, man, you know, thanks so much. This has been great.
All right,
I've had a great time.
Big thanks goes out to Jerry Lawson for providing us with probably one of the year's absolutely best interviews. Thank you, Jerry. Hope all of the friends that you've sent links out to the show are enjoying your interview. I certainly did. I never laughed so hard, I think, at CG, except for maybe Howard Scott Warshaw, which you guys are going to get to hear later in the year. That's some funny stuff right there. But Matt's takeaway from the great Jerry Lawson, thank you again for being with us. A great interview. Everybody agrees. Top notch, right up there with the David Cranes and the Don Bluths. You are my personal hero. As always, this month we have a stunningly large Bits and Bytes segment. Just a couple words about Bits and Bytes before we get started. I know everyone's eager. It's one of the favorite spots of the show for a lot of people. A lot of people also ask about some of the logistics of the show. How do we do this, or what's our procedure for doing that? And you'll notice that with Bits and Bytes the last few months or so, we've been trying a couple of new things in how to get the data from people. Originally, we started having people just email it in. Right? I mean, that seems pretty straightforward. Of course, that in itself is a challenge, to manage that many emails with that much information and cutting and pasting this and putting it in this database, putting it in that database. So it made a lot more sense to simply have people entering the information for me, even in a raw format, having it stuck in the database, and then at that point, massage the information into the format and whatever that I need. However, of course, even with that, you start having people entering titles that are really, really long and things like that. So we've massaged the process down to a point to where we can get the information we need. Bits and bytes submissions are no longer part of the regular submission process. They have their own special page now. And we've done a lot of things on the back end, especially starting with this show. We needed a methodology where we could have three different statuses of links. We don't want to have all the links online all the time. We like to be able to control when something gets turned on to the public. Otherwise, mass chaos and spamming and everything else bad could happen. So we have to control what gets online at any given time. But we also need to know whether or not we've looked at an item, whether or not we're currently reviewing that item for this current month's show, and whether the item is actually new that came in after our cutoff time for bits and bytes for this month. So using a series of flags and all sorts of other weird complicated crap that a lot of people probably don't care about, we've managed to filter the links in our back end so that we can actually see at any given time existing links, links that have been submitted that we've decided we're going to look at this month, and links that have been submitted since our cutoff time. This also gives us the opportunity to actually give individual credit on a per-link basis, because we do capture the person's submission info, providing they put it in there. So what we'll be doing from this month forward, and it may not be on right away because I have to write a little code for it, but from now on the Listen to the Show page, you're going to be able to hover over a link, and the title will pop up and tell you who contributed the link to the system and when. That way you can get an idea how fresh the news is, as well as if you're a member of the forum and this person is as well, you can drop them a line, a PM or something, say, hey, cool link, give a little appreciation, credit where credit's due. I'm a big fan of that. So instead of giving individual credit here on the show, which I always have to butcher somebody's name and dig up a big list, instead, I'm going to let the links speak for themselves from now on, and I think once a month I'm going to take one particular contributor and thank them personally for all their hard work and effort submitting stuff to the show. This month, I think it's no surprise when I tell you that this month I'd like to thank Fernando Garcia, our own intern information technology specialist here at Retro Gaming Radio, a.k.a. Flair, on the forums. Fernando is an amazing dude. Not only is he a great intern, he's also a wealth of knowledge of Retro Gaming Radio. This is a funny story. I was reading an interview with REM, the music group, and they've been around so long and done so much stuff that they said that when they get ready to go on tour, they actually go to music shops and buy the sheet music or buy the songs that they've recorded in the past so they can do them for the show, because it's been so long and they haven't done the stuff for so long, they don't remember the words to half of their stuff, that they actually go and buy books before their concerts. For some reason, that always seems funny to me that a group as big as like REM, who's been around that long, wouldn't like know their own songs. But then, you know, in this case, on the forums, a lot of times people say, well, didn't you talk about this at one time? I'm like, probably. And there's Flair popping right up saying, hey, yeah, that was on episode so-and-so. It's on this year's CD, and it's 57 minutes and 8 seconds into the show. That's devotion. That's dedication. Of course, he's a huge contributor to Bits and Bytes as well, which is why I wanted to kind of spotlight him here this month. So big thanks to Flair. Big thanks to everybody that contributes. But this month, we're thanking Flair in specific. And if we contact you on the side, don't be offended if we ask you to pronounce your name. I'm tired of not being able to pronounce poor people's names on the show. So we're going to try to fix that as well. Okay, I've prattled on for a good 5 minutes. That's some good filler time there. Let's get on with Bits and Bytes, shall we? Well, just one more thing before we get busy. A lot of people have asked about the opera.win file, and I was hoping it was a little easier to use than I had thought, but unfortunately it's not. Opera allows you to capture sessions, In other words, after I've looked at every link in Bits and Bytes that I'm looking for this month, I've got Opera open with about 400 items open in it. Now, these items all become available to you on the link page eventually, those that I end up using, whatever, end up going on the link page. Well, of course, that ends up being kind of a click fest. Sometimes you have to search for what you want, et cetera, et cetera. So I thought it'd be cool if I could capture the Opera session and save it and then produce that opera.win file, which is the session file, to my listeners who actually are using Opera, that they can use that to bring up all the pages that I was looking at. So you guys basically are seeing what I'm seeing. So I thought that'd be a cool idea. Unfortunately, the WIN files are not directly associated with Opera. So in order to use those WIN files, you got to drop them in Opera's session folder. And then when you open Opera next time, you go to File, Sessions, and you should see October Bits and Bytes, for example. In that session list, you can open it, and then all 400 windows or whatever will open for you. So I thought that'd be kind of a neat trick. I don't know how much longer I'm going to keep it. I was hoping Opera 9 might automatically associate it with that, but not looking good. So we'll see what happens. But I wanted to explain that off for people here online. A lot of people are excited about my renewed interest in Nintendo. And we do have several Bits and Bytes that were submitted this month regarding Nintendo, the Revolution, the DS, and other sort of historical information and business importance about Nintendo themselves. So I'm going to try to kind of keep these grouped together if I can. Here's an interesting article from IGN that was submitted called The Nintendo Minute Volume 2, and it's subtitled, Is 2005 Going to Be a Slow Year for GameCube Owners? Nintendo Response. And of course, they talk a lot about the new Zelda game and things like that, the exclusive release of Resident Evil 4. I think it's kind of funny, though, that 2005 did end up being a fairly slow year for the GameCube, even if Zelda had been released here in 2005. I'm not totally sure that Zelda and Resident Evil 4... Now, hey, don't get me wrong, Resident Evil 4 stomps major ass, but I don't know. I don't know if I would consider this a big year. All in all, though, if you look at some of the other titles that they mention in here, a lot of this stuff did indeed ship for GameCube, and despite the fact that a lot of people look at console quality as being the number of titles released, I tend to look at quality of titles released. How many great games did I play last year on the GameCube? How many great games did I play last year on the PlayStation 2? Those are the sort of questions that I ask myself. Not how many games, but what were the games? Resident Evil 4 definitely was one of the highlights of 2005 for me. And that came from GameCube alone. So, good stuff. You know, interesting stuff to read. I like to kind of keep track of that stuff, and I have a lot of diehard Nintendo fans. Oh, let's see. Are you a metrosexual? This is kind of funny. Somebody sent me a quiz. I'm not sure if this is any kind of insinuation or not. But it's a quiz that'll let you find out if you're metrosexual. How does this relate to gaming, classic gaming, or retro gaming in general? No clue, but it's funny anyway. Some of the questions, number one, how many times do you look in a mirror every day? The answers are once, when I wake up, twice, morning and evening, three times, a little midday peak, four times, I have uncooperative hair, at least five, get off my case. If nothing else, that's a fun distraction for those of you who think that stuff's funny. I do, so what can I tell you? Okay. Japanese sales chart show handheld trends. Interesting article here from GameSpot. DS outselling PSP in Japan. Game lineup cited as reason. Interestingly enough, a lot of people are still finding quality in the DS that they're not seeing in the PSP from a commercial game standpoint. Game Boy Micro mania is finally simmering down, considered a little too pricey. Before I continue, I did get a chance finally to put my hands on a Game Boy Micro. And I'll tell you, despite the fact that we all know that it's geared towards the Paris Hiltons and the, you know, stupid spoiled whores, it's actually a pretty neat little piece of hardware in terms of how big it is, how clear the screen is. And they're right, folks. I was skeptical. I did not think that you could have a screen that looked better than the DS screen on a Nintendo handheld, and I was wrong. The Game Boy Micro is crisp. Crisp and clean. You really can read the text on the screen. I was stunned.
Very durable unit, too. It actually feels solid. It doesn't feel cheap. I thought it'd feel really cheap. But it feels very durable. I should expect more from Nintendo by now. But anyway, would I buy one for $100? Absolutely not. Was I thinking about it for a few minutes? Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about it for a minute, buying one. But then I realized I've got like 3 SPs at home, 3 DSs. I don't need another shot on the technology. But, you know, when these things drop in price, and they're maybe $59, and I can get one used in good shape, we'll see. It's pretty cool. I could give a rat's ass about the faceplates and everything else. But I thought it was pretty interesting, a little durable piece of hardware. Pretty good stuff. Anyway, so you can read about the Japanese sales charts. According to the survey, the biggest issue for DS owners is the machine's design. 31.3% of Japanese gamers complained about its size and weight, especially since the handheld is often played with one hand holding the stylus. On the other hand, PSP owners see their handheld design as the second best selling point, followed by its various hardware functions. However, hardware functions are also the selling point for the DS, with 61.8% of owners saying they like the touchscreen controls. You can read more about that, folks, at the article. I'll provide you with a link. Somebody has lost their frickin' minds and created Final Fantasy X for the NES. And I'll read a little bit of the text here for you. This has got to be the most complicated NES hack to date. A group of Japanese ROM hackers recreated Final Fantasy X using the Final Fantasy 2J ROM as a base. All of the graphics have been scaled down to 2D, but they still look impressive with the NES's limited palette. Cutscenes in the game have been reworked, not eliminated. For example, the underwater scene between Yuna and Titus, still exist. The battle system has been recreated. 2 limit breaks were added along with button presses for Oron Bushido's attacks, whatever that means. The magic system has been reworked from the ground up to include more spells as seen in Final Fantasy X. So, if you are a Final Fantasy fan, NES fan, can't wait to see Final Fantasy X on the NES, now is your chance. We've talked a lot about Nintendo's smartness and their intelligence. Smartness, is that even a word? In the last few months, we've talked a little bit about how Nintendo is really the smarter company. They're not interested in losing tons of cash and owning marketplaces. They're happy to sit in their little third place and make more profit than either two companies that sit ahead of it in the video game division. Here's another great article about called Rope-A-Dope, Nintendo is Smarter Than We Think. This is good stuff. I would definitely read it. It's fairly intelligently written. We've seen other articles like this before. There's several different things in here. It's not, shall I say, Academy Award-winning work, but it's definitely information that I think you'll find interesting. I don't know. They relate a lot to boxing and things like that, which I don't relate to, but whatever. A lot of you probably will. Let's see. What's next on here? Yes. Steven Spielberg takes film magic to EA. Steven Spielberg, who worked his magic with E.T., is now looking to do the same thing with games giant Electronic Arts. The acclaimed film director has already agreed to develop 3 original games with Electronic Arts Los Angeles Studios. Work has already started on the first of 3 projects. Will be a next-generation game which appeals to a broad audience. Now, to me, that's an oxymoron, a next-generation game that appeals to a broad audience. So, anyway, you can read all about how Spielberg and EA are going to revolutionize the, and probably monopolize, the movie license, video game movie connection. I just can't wait. Nothing more than I like to see good buddies like Spielberg working with my best friends over at EA. We talked about, and you probably, depending on how you've skipped around the show this month, you know that we are doing a review of Taito Legends. The guys behind Taito Legends have agreed to do a little interview here. And once again, being Japanese names, I am absolutely certain that I will chop them up. Actually, there's more than one or two guys here. There's different people. In fact, you know what? I'm not even going to bother trying to pronounce these names. Some of these are just not going to happen for me. Anyway, so you can read about this. There's some good stuff. They got some good images, conceptual drawings. Actually, really good stuff from Edge Video Game Culture. I think this is one of the first months I've gotten something from these guys. So, good stuff. Read about it, and definitely listen to our review of Taito Legends, because it's good stuff for a change. I know. Home emulation package is actually good. Figure the odds. A couple of interesting things about the Nintendo Revolution. While it's certainly not retro gaming, it will be a huge source of retro gaming. As we already know, Nintendo plans to offer fully emulated back titles, back catalog titles. 221 back titles was the number I heard last, where you will be able to get all of these great titles and download them Wi-Fi onto your Revolution and play them, things like Super Mario Brothers, Duck Hunt, etc., etc. So, from a classic gaming point of view, the Revolution is a very interesting possibility. One of the things, well, actually two things that people have talked about in terms of the Revolution, aside from the controller, which is the obvious media darling right now, Nintendo's launch price and their graphic capabilities are what are the two things on Nintendo lovers' lips. How much is that Nintendo Revolution going to cost? And how good is it going to stand up? Because whether we like it or not, women are constantly impressed with how much liquor a man can drink, and gamers are considerably impressed with how a game looks, whether or not it plays well or not. So the two things we're worried about are price and graphic capabilities. According to a recent interview, which I do not have in front of me, somebody went on record as saying there will be little to no discernation, if that's the right word, between Nintendo's Revolution and the Xbox 360. From a graphics perspective, the games will look almost exactly the same. That's good news, because while I could really give a rat's ass whether I'm playing block characters or I'm playing ultra-elite high-res bitmap multi-textured volumetric fog with pushing 17 billion polygons per second at 120 frames per second, I don't give a rat's ass. I care about how fun the game is. But unfortunately, far too many other people do care what it looks like. So that's good news. The other thing is, how much is it going to cost? As we all know, next-generation consoles are already starting off being incredibly priced. $299, $399, $499, $49.99, depending on if you want that plasma TV with your Xbox 360. In any event, this article from Joystick says the Revolution price could indeed be $99. Now, could you imagine what that would do for Nintendo if they could actually release that console at $99? But I seriously doubt it. It's a nice thought. It's a great rumor. And I think it would be totally stunning to see the Revolution come out at $99. But I'm not optimistic. There may be a version of the Revolution out for $99, but it may not be what you actually want to take home. So worth checking out that article, Joystick. The hot coffee mod for GTA San Andreas has been, of course, lots of media stirrings these last few months. But this month we have something that's not quite so media stirring, but still cool. Similar in vein, without the naked chicks and sex, is unlocking a starship or a Star Fox ship in the Zelda game. From the article, think of it as hot coffee without all the lawsuits and sex. Looks like some goofy Nintendo programmer slipped an R-Wing fighter? Sorry, I never played Star Fox. Fighter from Star Fox into Ocarina of Time. Which, by the way, Ocarina was helpfully pointed out to me as a woodwind instrument, not a Japanese name. A reader sent me this screen cap along with a link to the video. In it, you can see Link spotting the spaceship. Just in case you absolutely need to check this out for yourself, run out and buy a Game Shark and use this code to unlock the space-time anomaly. And they got a picture there showing Link looking at the ship. That's pretty cool. I like having little Easter eggs like that tucked around in the games. Okay, best launch titles. This is one of my favorite, most repugnant articles that I've gotten this month. According to GameSpot, the absolute best launch titles. Now, we all know what launch titles are, right? They're games that come out at the same time as the consoles do, usually for the early adopters to get their hands on some of the latest games for the latest technology. So we're going to talk a little bit about this article. We're going to look at some of the information, and I'll let you know whether or not I agree or disagree. Number 13, that's a very interesting number to start with, which is 13. I don't know why 13. Oh, here we go. Because there are too many amazing Super Mario games to limit the list to 10. That's what they said. Number 13, Castlevania Circle of the Moon for the GBA. Frankly, I don't know much about Castlevania, especially not back in that generation. Ask me about Castlevania Dawn of Sorrow, I can tell you something. Circle of the Moon can't tell you a lot. But I can tell you that the GBA's best launch title was probably not that. We'll see though. Let me go through the list here. Ridge Racer for the PlayStation. I don't know if I was ever a big Ridge Racer fan. I wasn't around when the PlayStation launched, so I can't really comment on that. I wasn't around for the launch date of the PlayStation, so maybe that's true. NFL 2K on the Dreamcast. Absolutely not. Launch day, best title ever on the Dreamcast, we all know is Soul Calibur, which did get honorable mention in here. But let's be honest, folks, not true. California Games on the Lynx. Nice to see the Lynx getting a little bit of press. It's very cool, but I don't know if I would call it the best launch title. There were so many good titles. Now, again, my history could be a little hazy. Maybe that was one of the few games that were released. But honestly, I think Road Blasters came out at the same time, and frankly, Road Blasters has the best Lynx title hands down to me in terms of almost a near-perfect port from the arcade game. California Games is definitely cool. It definitely looked good. It played good. It's from my buddies at Epix, so what do you want? Sega Saturn got Panzer Dragoon for number 9 on the list. The Panzer series was more successful than the console it started on, the subheading underneath the title. On the PS2, SSX was the great launch title according to this list. Again, I wasn't around for the PS2's launch. Can't really tell you. Combat on the 2600. You know, I might have to agree with that one. Combat was definitely one kick-ass game, especially for the time frame that you're working with. It's great stuff. It's great stuff. Let's move on to 6 through 1 on the list, provided my internet connection eventually brings it up. Things have been rather slow. And here's what I get for not looking a page ahead. Soul Calibur for the Dreamcast clocks in at number 6. Good boys. Good boys. I might actually put that slightly higher on the list than 6, because quite frankly, Soul Calibur, even today, is still one of the best-looking fighters around, and it's on a dead old machine. Number 5, Halo for the Xbox. Based on sales, hard to dispute that. Number 4, Super Mario Brothers on the NES. There you go. That might have actually needed to have been a little higher on the list, to be honest with you, despite the fact that I was no NES head. Number 3 on the list, Super Mario 64 for the N64. Definitely groundbreaking, revolutionary, etc., etc. Probably deserves to be on the list. Super Mario World on the NES. Can't say that I really agree with that one. I was kind of around for that, and while it was a decent game, to be sure, I'm not sure that it would deserve to be number 2, especially over Mario 64 and the original Mario Brothers. And yes, we actually agree on the absolute top number 1 title, which is Tetris on the Game Boy. Very much so, a great title, probably the best pack-in ever. Now, I do want to say, though, that the only thing that I was very disturbed with on this list that did not own up was ColecoVision. ColecoVision had the absolute best pack-in ever, their best game, Donkey Kong. The closest to the arcade you could get at the time, Donkey Kong on the ColecoVision would have been, outside of this list, my number one pick for the best pack-in ever. Because, frankly, it was the smartest thing ever. They made them tons of cash. It put them squarely on the map and in the lead. That to me, but I'll tell you what, for being the number one here, Tetris Game Boy is not an insult to me. So that's pretty good stuff. Good list. Sort of. There's some decent stuff on the list. I don't know if I would call it a great list. One of our readers wrote in to talk about Space Scramble, a retro space shooter for the new millennium. This is basically a 3D-ized, not 3D-ized, but 3D-enhanced version of the classic game Scramble. It's one of those cases where I like the thought process behind it. I love Scramble. In this case, I played a couple of rounds of this, and for some reason, everything just seems a bit too big. You know how I'm usually complaining about how things are too small and the original feel of the game is kind of lost? This is sort of the antithesis of that. This is sort of, everything's a little too big for me to feel like I'm playing the original game. But definitely check it out. I mean, it's one of the more truer to the original game style retro-themed remakes. So it's definitely worth bringing up. But there was some interesting things about it. The size of the graphics just kind of get to me. It's cool looking, but eh. Yeah. Space Scramble from TC Consulting, brought to you by Reflexive Arcade. Of course, everybody knows them. So check that out. I will give you a link. I got nicely enough sent to me by the original author. A lot of people know what Scum is, Scum VM. It is a virtual machine for playing the old point-and-click adventures, like the LucasArts point-and-click adventures, things like Secret of Monkey Island. Tons and tons and tons of games came out. Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis. There is a die-hard collection of people that indeed and truly love, absolutely love these type of games. Now, I was never a point-and-click kind of guy, but for adventure games. I played a few of them, and there are some good things in here. But, again, you know, this was not exactly my cup of tea, and for me to get super passionate about it is just not going to happen. However, these guys have nicely enough made a port to the Nintendo DS. You can play all these classic games on the DS with full sound, and it's very nice. They use the touchscreen interface. They use both screens, which is pretty cool. Let me see if I can find a list here of what this supports. There's some good stuff in here. Let's see. Runs nearly all of LucasArts' Scum games, up to and including Sam & Max Hit the Road. Supports sound. Supports multiple games without reflashing. Supports using the DS touchscreen for controls. Supports saving games to compatible flash cards. That's huge. All games run at pretty much full speed. They got some screenshots for you to look at, and they were very nice to send me out a fully working version of Scum VM DS for me to look at with a couple of great Amiga Classic games in it. However, this is not the way it works for the general population. In other words, you're going to have to take the effort to create your own Scum VM DS file. And they give you full instructions on the site how to do it. All of these games are still copyright. They're not going to give you any games with this emulator, and nor should they. Mine was for purely evaluation purposes, for the purposes of this review. And, of course, I have already destroyed the file. In fact, hell, I probably owned half of these games at one point in time or another. Even though I wasn't a big fan, I still bought a lot of software. Especially the Indiana Jones stuff. But anyway, so they'll give you the whole spiel about how to make it, how to put it on your flash cart, etc., etc. It's all right here. So good. It was very nice of them to go through the extra effort to send me that information. I will give you a link to the site. This is Scum VM DS, a port by Neil Millstone. Good guy, good stuff. Help him out. Visit the site and check it out. Always like to see emulation on the DS. Remember last month we talked about how goofy as hell it was that Xbox won an Emmy Award? Well, I'm starting to think that I'm going to be able to win an Emmy Award for shaving the back of my ass. Because now, the original PlayStation had to win an Emmy Award. Sony's first console receives a prestigious award for pioneering the 3D gaming field. You can just read this on your own, folks. I just cannot get into the specifics again of why the hell I don't believe that video game consoles deserve Emmy Awards. Losers! Anyway, check that out. A lot of people have been talking about what you're going to be able to do with the Nintendo Revolution controllers. Frankly, a friend of mine sat in the office with me at work one day, and we were shooting the breeze, and we were talking about all the cool stuff that could be done with a Nintendo Revolution controller. These guys have been talking about and making mock-ups of what a game controller, a shotgun controller, might look like. And what indeed... Sorry. Whew. That just came right out. Couldn't stop the yawn. And indeed what Duck Hunt might look like using the Revolution's graphics and a Revolution shotgun. I know what you're thinking. This looks like Deliverance Revisited. It could well be. But anyway, check it out. I don't want to harp too much on the Revolution stuff because I got more of this in the queue. But I thought it was kind of cool that people are making mock-ups and everything already. Interesting stuff. We had some other mock-ups last month, so if you missed out on that, check that out. Hey, Sony has lost a legal battle in Australia over the modifying of PlayStation game consoles. The High Court has ruled that chipping the console so it can play imported games does not breach copyright law. This ruling ends a 4-year legal battle between Sony and a supplier of so-called mod chips, which bypass regional controls on the machine. In the UK, the selling of mod chips was ruled illegal in 2004. However, in Australia, you can mod that PlayStation all you want, and it's totally legal. Good stuff. I mean, I understand the point of Sony, but I also understand the point of the gamer. This region lock crap and exclusivity and all that other stuff just makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck. So it's nice to see that there's some precedent set in the legal community about being able to legitimately use bypasses on this type of thing. Man, you know, this list just isn't even dwindling down at all. September sales down 24%, sales down across the board. Huge numbers of 2004 set a bar. 2005 just can't measure up to. Heading into the release of NPD Fun World's September sales projections Thursday, analysts braced themselves for the bad news. They had no delusions that September 2005's lineup of games, spearheaded by Activision's X-Men Legends 2 and the annual onslaught of EA Sports games, could measure up to September 2004, where hits like Pokemon Red Fire and Leaf Green Fable and Star Wars Battlefront combined for approximately $95 million in sales alone. Sales that month were up a whopping 44% over September of 2003, and without a slack lineup of surefire hits on the month's release list this year, a pessimistic view of the short term prevailed. Even so, the actual Fun World numbers were worse than analysts predicted, worse than the predictions of analysts who dared to put a number on the slide at any rate. Anyway, so some interesting things here. Maybe gaming is not the iron powerhouse that everybody's talking about. Anyway, interesting stuff here to follow up on how long it'll take the industry to rebound, etc., etc. Christmas time's coming up. They should be selling crap loads of stuff, but we'll see what happens. Industry is very fickle. Sudoku. I don't know why, but for some reason, Sudoku, I'm going to spend forever trying to pronounce this, Sudoku, for some reason, I got tons and tons of independent emails about Sudoku. It is an interesting non-mathematical numeric grid-based challenge. They've got computer software. They've got online versions. They've got puzzle books. This is one of those things where I'm still trying to wrap my hands around the concept of why this is popular. You basically fill this grid in. It's 9x9. You fill the grid in so that every row, every column has every 3x3 box containing the digits 1 through 9. Sometimes you're supposed to get 1 through 9 along the axis, the full horizontal or vertical axis. Sometimes you're supposed to get it in a single box. You can't duplicate numbers. I mean, there's some skill involved in it, but I'm just not entertained by it. I sat down and tried to do it, and it's like, okay, what am I missing out on here? I mean, this is okay, it's kind of fun, but is this something I do a lot? Is this something that I would expect like 17 people to write in to me about? No. So, Sudoku, however you put the inflection on it, is obviously here to stay, and people are making mad fat cash off it. What can I tell you? So if you're interested in quirky grid-based number puzzle games, this is for you. We have several links provided by our listeners. More on Nintendo's Wi-Fi service. Man, there's been good stuff in here. First of all, Nintendo ain't dumb. Despite what everybody might say about the revolution and the controller being a big risk, Nintendo ain't dumb. They know what's going on. The more I watch their business strategy, the more I understand completely what they're up to. First of all, we have the full details of the Wi-Fi service, which you've probably already read if you're already curious about it. But I have a link to the full Wi-Fi that actually shows a picture of the USB Wi-Fi USB connector. Some of the things that we did not know at the time of this particular article was that this Wi-Fi connector would also be usable on the Revolution. So you buy the Wi-Fi connector now, and it will be usable for the Revolution next year. Also, some other interesting news about our buddies over at Nintendo. They have secured like 6,300. I have an article in here somewhere. I thought I remember the number off the top of my head, but alas, I did not. Something in the lines of 6,300 McDonald's are going to offer this Wi-Fi Nintendo service. Now, here's the kicker. A lot of times you pay X number of dollars per hour for 2 hours to sit and play Wi-Fi stuff or access their Wi-Fi hotspot at McDonald's. Nintendo assures us that all McDonald's Wi-Fi for the Nintendo DS will be free. Brilliant. Nintendo hasn't stopped in the U.S. either. They've negotiated a couple of other places in the U.S. as well, still pending. And they've also tapped one of Canada's largest hotel chains to provide free Wi-Fi access in their X number of hotels. And again, I apologize, I don't have the number right in front of me, but I do have them in here, and as soon as I run across them again, I will mention it to you. So anyway, Nintendo's doing a smart job with getting this Wi-Fi service in place. I do believe it goes live on either the 11th or the 25th. I've got conflicting numbers. We'll see. It's going to be this month in November, next month in November. This is still October show. So I've got tons of stuff for you to look at about the Wi-Fi service. I really think that this is the right way to do it. I really do. I think Nintendo bided their time until they could get to a point where they felt they could release it for free. The infrastructure was in place. They could do it easy. Blah, blah, blah. I think that they're smart in what they're doing. Hey, we talk a lot about pinball on the show, more in latter shows with Brian, of course, when he was still with us. We talked a lot about pinball, and a lot of people have asked me personally about Metroid Pinball for the Nintendo DS. For those of you who are not a member of our forums, I would definitely recommend you go over there. I posted a giant review of Metroid Pinball, so I won't talk too much about it. But suffice to say, everybody loves it. GameSpot gave it an 8.2, which is a great score. It's a brilliant pinball game for those of you who don't think or don't believe that portable pinball can be fun. My wife and my copy of Metroid Pinball would beg to differ. Yes, it was so good that my wife had to have her own copy. That's usually a good indicator of a game's quality when my wife wants her own. So, good stuff. I'll post a link to a review. You can look at the screenshots. I'm having a lot of fun with it. Plus, it comes, of course, with the first Rumble Pack for the Nintendo DS. Surely usable in future games, the Rumble Pack really adds an air of video pinball never before seen. There's something special about the Rumble Pack. If you go and look at one of these games on a kiosk at a store and you play Metroid Prime Pinball, don't let that be your final experience with it. Because with the Rumble Pack, it really makes a difference. Never was a big supporter of the Rumble Pack until now. I really think it works out. Along with our discussion here, Time Magazine, in their What's Next issue in November 2005, Time Magazine lists the Nintendo Revolution Controller as one of the five new things that will blow your mind. Thanks, Time Magazine, for recognizing something cool. There's also some other interesting things in that article. I don't remember if I have a link to it, but they have some sort of a non-fat deep-frying compound and some other things listed. If you're a Time Magazine subscriber or you watch their website, I think you can look at the full article there, too. It's a good article, other than the fact that it talks about Nintendo Revolution, if you like talking about the technology stuff. Every single month, I get sent something about hacking something into something else. And the more I talk about it, I guess the more people keep sending me stuff. Somebody has hacked a DVD player into an NES. The only thing that makes my lonesome Friday night better is watching Army of Darkness yet again on a brand new vintage NES DVD player. Brandon over at Milk My Cow managed to cram a DVD player inside an NES console. The NES power button is still fully functional and the DVD tray manages to open and close the flip lid on its own. I don't know, man. There's got to be something better to do with your free time. eBay is often known for people horking stolen goods, releasing prototypes that aren't prototypes, defrauding the general public. There was an eBay auction recently that claimed to have an unreleased Zelda 3 game for the NES. The auction went down. And apparently the NES cart, the Zelda 3 cart for the NES, is actually real, according to joystick.com. So if you're a huge Zelda fan and this is of interest to you, you might want to check it out. This also brings up the other question is, what do you do with something like this? Now that you own the game and it's legitimately is proven, do you stick it in a plastic baggie and stuff it in the closet? Or do you dump it, distribute the ROM for other people to play? It's a tough question. I'll tell you what, though. I don't think that people should hoard stuff like this, personally. Marble Madness 2 is a prime example. There's like two of these in existence. The guy that's got the one that works won't dump the ROMs because he likes being the only person on the high score, the world record high score table for being playing Marble Madness 2. So I really think that this sort of stuff should be shared. I mean, I understand wanting the eliteness of being the only person in existence to have it, and you still do. You're the only person with a Zelda 3 cartridge. You're the only person with Marble Madness 2. Help out the community, man. If everybody hoarded all this crap, you know what? You know, nobody'd be enjoying anything. So that's kind of my thoughts on it. The lawsuit, EA's overtime lawsuit, just when you thought you've heard enough about EA and the overtime lawsuit, we have an article, we have a settlement. Late last year, an anonymous post from an EA spouse made public an important but oft-ignored issue in computer games development, that is, of quality of life. The post, which outlined some of the grave liberties the Canadian Uber publisher took and continues to take with its employees, ricocheted around the web and mainstream newsprint. Quality of life has since been a point of contention at various conferences and has been addressed in the Independent Game Developers Association Quality of Life white paper. To date, on paper and practice, not a lot has happened to tackle these issues, and EA's spouse has taken a backseat to the lore of overworked industry circles. In June, two parties took EA to court, filing suit against its unhealthy and exploitive, underpaid overtime work policy. Settled Wednesday for $15.6 million. Not a lot of cash, to be honest with you. Not a lot of money for all the things that people put up with working at EA. What can I tell you? Couple of interesting articles this month from old school stuff, old school interviews with David Crane, developer of Pitfall, Space Shuttle, Ghostbusters, Little Computer People, it goes on and on. So we've, of course, talked to David Crane at great length for over 2 hours on the show. It was probably one of the best interviews ever on Retro Gaming Radio. One article called Ghost in the Machine, it's from a Spectrum website, Spectrum Sinclair website. Wait a minute. Spectrum and Sinclair the same thing? I don't know. I'd have to look it up. It shows how much I know. Anyway, this is from the Your Sinclair Rock and Roll Years website. It's an interview with David Crane, an early one. Good stuff. I would definitely recommend taking a look at it. Some interesting stuff in here. There's also another article that I have posted here, another David Crane interview that I think you will find interesting. Both of these, incidentally, sent by our good friend New Kinetics over on the forums. I know I wasn't going to address anybody personally on these things, but he always manages to come up with some of the most interesting stuff. The other interview is the David Crane Hotline interview from Issue 8. Considerably older. It was from the old Zap 64. Interesting to look at this article on David Crane. Interesting guy. I don't necessarily believe his current technological jump. Hey, advertising in video games. I'm not sure I'm a big fan of that, but he's made a market off of it, so good for him. Branded themed games. They're making money and they're still around. It's nice to see that some of the retro talent is still doing stuff. Anyway, good stuff. Good stuff on David Crane. A lot of the a lot of people talk about video gaming as being about graphics or about gameplay or numerous other factors. What a lot of people don't talk about, though, is how the controller of a console fits into the big scheme of things. A lot of people will talk about the 2600 controller. A lot of people will talk about the Wico Bat Handle controller. A lot of people will talk about creepy controllers like the Intellivision controller, the 5200 controller, controllers that break easily. But interestingly enough, we have a family tree for console controllers. Kind of interesting. It shows the evolution of controllers as they've gone throughout the ages. Interesting look. It won't take you long to take a peek at that. Interesting stuff. Sockmaster's game controller, game console controller family tree. A good link, good information. Kind of interesting to see how all the controllers lay out. And even the Revolution controller is on there. Very interesting stuff. There's a lot of PC gamers still out there, although our numbers are dwindling quickly. For those of you who must play first-person shooters, who must play those keyboard, mouse, intensive games, Logitech apparently now has something called the G15 Gaming Keyboard. Logitech was amongst the first vendors to come out with the game-focused PC mice, offering higher precision and better performance at a premium price. Although the company continued that tradition over the last couple of years, as well as developing and selling traditional game peripherals like joysticks and gamepads, only recently has Logitech seen fit to give PC gaming peripherals their own product line. So they have a G series, which apparently consists of a mouse, some other stuff. Anyway, if you're interested in something like this, they have got unbelievable looking keyboards. I think they're even wireless based on the fact that I think there might be a little antenna sticking out of that thing. I don't know. Yeah, it looks like a cable. I don't even know why there'd even be an antenna anymore, but who knows? Maybe you really need to play your game from 150 feet away. It could happen. Anyway, so here you go. Logitech's gaming keyboard. Not too many people I know even game on the PC anymore. It's hard to blame them. It's a pain in the ass. There's another article on Sudoku. Man, I just can't believe how many people wrote in on this stuff. Hey, now here's something interesting, something brand new that deals with classic emulation. The first Philips CDI, Compact Disc Interactive emulator, is up and running. And you can get it. All you got to do is figure out how to get the system ROMs, which I'm sure you can get them if you own an original CDI, or, of course, if you happen to know where to get them. You can actually run Philips CDI software right here on this emulator. For those of you who weren't familiar with the CDI, it was a botched attempt from Philips to bring an interactive compact disc media gaming entertainment center back in the old school days, I believe early 90s. Let me see if there's an actual date on here of when this guy came out. It was a nice idea. They had the right idea in mind, but at that point in time, you couldn't pull it off. Now, many of you probably know that the CDI had a full motion video cartridge. You could actually watch real movies like video CDs. They came up with their own standard for video compression. I can't remember if it was called like white book or orange book format. In any event, they basically encrypted it. They said, well, these discs are only going to play with the CDI. You're not going to be able to play them on any other players, etc., etc. And funny enough, and those of you who've been around a while know the backstory to this, the Commodore CD32 was a competitive product that also had a limited release of full motion video card as well. And at the last minute, before anybody even saw it coming, Commodore's technicians managed to crack the encryption system on these Orange Book or whatever it was format, and they actually managed to include playback of that format inside of the Commodore CD32, which of course pissed Philips off to no end, which is probably part of the deal. I'm sure that's part of the reason why they did it, was to piss them off. But in any event, I still have a couple of those games, a couple of those movies, Adam's Family Values and Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. I actually have those on a format that will play on the CD32 if you've got a full-motion video cartridge. They will not, in fact, play in a video DVD player or a video CD player. They won't play on a computer. The only way that I was able to get to the video on that was to extract the MPEG frames manually. Interesting stuff. I mean, there's an interesting lore behind all of this old video compression and old file formats. It's worth looking into. But anyway, so this is the first time that we actually have had an opportunity to see the Philips CDI as an emulator. Now, I'm not sure what you would play on it. There were several interactive titles for the CDI. In fact, I almost had to buy one because the Philips CDI was one of the first gaming-style consoles that would actually play a realistic-looking version of Dragon's Lair and Space Ace. You guys know me. I'm a slut for the Dragon's Lair. I'm a slut for the Space Ace. And so this would have been my way of getting in on that. Ah, hey, here's another Nintendo Minute article. When will Nintendo reveal Revolution's real name? Reggie Fils-Aimé. These names are killing me here. I can't even do French names, it looks like. VP of Corporate Affairs, Perrin Kaplan, or VP of Marketing and Corporate Communications, George Harrison. These are the three company bigwigs that talk about this stuff in the article. If you're interested in learning more about the future of the Revolution, this is an interesting little article to learn more about it. Man, the list just doesn't dwindle down here. Crucify the Average Gamers. These articles are written for entertainment only, for laughs and giggles. The contents of this article are not to be taken seriously and does not necessarily represent the view of Advanced Media or any of its employees. The Average Gamer, bringing the industry down one purchase at a time. What is an average gamer? It's the kid next door that calls you because he's stuck in Pokemon Snap. It's your friend that inquires whether he should buy Big Mother Truckers or the new Mary-Kate and Ashley game. Average gamers are void of gaming roots and don't bother to do a little research on what they should buy. And most of the time, these people are borderline retarded. Great article. Just by that, you should be able to get a good feel for what the rest of the article is. There's nothing more funny than seeing a bed with Star Wars Rogue Squadron and Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen game under the sheets together. Star Wars is not gay. Definitely check that article out. That's some pretty funny stuff. What can I tell you? I like seeing people with a sense of humor. Possibly one of the worst websites I've ever had the displeasure of looking at is Time Warp Vintage Toys. Time Warp is a company that deals with 50s, 60s, 70s toy collections. Some of the things that you'll see that are for sale here are some of the creepy old monkeys with the banana in their hands. Remember those ones, the monkeys that wore like the overalls? Remember those? Creepy stuff. I'm a huge nostalgia toy freak, but some of this stuff freaks me out. What are some of the other things they have for sale here? Halloween party lots from 1940s and the 50s. Kind of creepy. Let's see. What else we got in here? I love what these guys are up to, but this site sucks so bad. I mean, it's barely capable of putting up what it should be doing. Yogi Wall Walker. It's a wind-up bird with suction cup. Remember that one? I remember that one. A magic set from the 40s. Animal alphabet wooden letters. Things made out of wood. What do you find that anymore, right? A lot of this stuff doesn't have pictures, so I'm trying to skim through it. Let's see. What else do we got here? Johnny Eagle Lieutenant Pistol. I mean, some of this stuff is like... I mean, well outdates me, to be sure. There's always some classic gaming stuff tucked in here, and this site changes so frequently that... you can never be sure. The original 12-inch G.I. Joe with the fuzzy head. Man, I haven't seen some of this stuff in years. Let me scroll down a little bit and see if I can find something else. Flintstones Interactive Building Boulders. Those are all older toys. Let me see if I can get something from the 70s here. Fisher-Price Movie Theater Box. Remember those? They were like a thing you could put these cartridges in, and you could watch this like cartoon in this little tiny window. It was like one of those slide viewers, except for it watched video. What are some of the other stuff in here? Anyway, you guys can go through this on your own. I just think that it's fascinating. Weeble's Treasure Island. Weeble's Ranch. Remember the Weeble's? The Weeble's wobbles, but they don't fall down? There you go. Inchworm. Remember the Inchworm? That stupid thing that you would ride like a big wheel, except for you had to like pump up and down like you were like getting laid really well. This was it. The Inchworm Ride on from Hasbro. It's right here. You can actually buy one. Creepy. That go, by the way, if you're interested, that's going for 250 bones. Very cool stuff. Hey, here's one more thing I've just got to talk about. Do you remember those clackers? I forgot totally what these things were called. They don't even have them anymore. Remember, these were these glass balls. This is insanity. They were acrylic, not glass. They were balls on strings, and they came up to a ring. There were two balls on strings attached to a ring, and you would knock them together slowly until you got the rhythm right, and then you would be able to knock them faster and faster. They don't even make these things anymore. Kids were breaking their arms with this stuff. So you can actually buy these clackers here. I almost have to have one for $35. That's kind of pricey. But you guys have got to check some of this stuff out. This is old school stuff. Just try to avoid the bad website. Just try to overlook that because they got some good stuff on here. So Time Warp Vintage Toys. Good stuff. Good stuff. Next up, an article called Gamers Aren't Weirdos and They Make Excellent Employees. Boomers beware, a new generation of workers on the corporate fast track, and they've had no end of practice salvaging the competition. Call them gamer generation. Y'all know what generation I call them. The gamer generation that spent their time sitting in front of a TV playing Crash Bandicoot is better off than the baby boomer generation that sat in front of the TV watching Gilligan's Island, says John C. Beck. And Beck ought to know, he and fellow research strategist Mitchell Wade surveyed 2,500 of the 90 million active gamers in this country, according to their book, Got Game, How the Gamer Generation is Reshaping Business Forever. Gamers are smart, savvy, new thinkers who climb the corporate ladder using the same problem-solving strategies they used to come out winners in games such as Doom and Mortal Kombat. Now, I know a lot of generation gaming people, and I ain't seeing these smart, savvy people. I see 30-year-olds living in the basement of their mom's place playing Halo 2 for 18 hours a day. The things parents and adults miss in games is cognitive skills that are being developed below the surface of graphics. You know what? People don't care about the cognitive skills they're building. They care about the graphics. Anyway, good article. I could sit and rant all day about it, but we all know my stance on it. Several people wrote in to let me know that Peter Jackson, the Lord of the Rings guy that managed to get more recognition than Tolkien ever did for his work, is now getting to do Halo. He's the Triple Academy Award winner, Peter Jackson, will executive produce Halo, the upcoming film based on Microsoft's popular video game. I haven't seen Doom yet, and the jury's still out on whether that was a decent movie to translation, movie to video game to movie translation, rather. I don't know if I can even read this. Commenting on the announcement, Peter Jackson said, "As a gaming fan, I'm excited to bring Halo's premise, action, and settings to the screen with all the specificity and reality today's technology can provide. Fran and I are intrigued by the unique challenges this project offers, and we're delighted to be working again with our friends at Universal and our new ones at Fox and Microsoft. I'm a huge fan of the game and look forward to helping it come alive on the cinema screen." Does anybody want to wager any guess that he's never played Halo? Because I'm betting that's the case. I've got several articles of that kicking around, so you should see more than one link. Dungeon Doom. Yes, do you dare? This is a mod for Doom 3 that apparently offers something new. Let's take a look at Dungeon Doom. Right from the website, Dungeon Doom is a Doom 3 modification for Windows, Linux, and Macintosh. Dungeon Doom incorporates most key features of roguelike games. In particular, levels are largely composed of mazes which are generated from a pseudo-random number generator. Levels have stairs either leading to higher or lower levels of the dungeon. The lower the player descends in the dungeon, the stronger the enemies get. Killed enemies drop gold, which can then be used in the shops to buy weapons and ammo. Much of this functionality is not part of the original Doom 3 engine. It has been added by Dungeon Doom. Modification is highly extensible, and current 6.0 builds of Dungeon Doom include an overworld, a storyline, random quests, and special level bosses. You know, this sounds pretty decent, to be honest with you. Now, I haven't had a chance to look at it, of course. I'm a very busy guy. But I would definitely like to hear if any of you have tried it and discuss it on our message forums. Because I've always kind of liked the old rogue hack style games. And if this can deliver on that, even if it does have to use the Doom 3 engine, I'm definitely interested. So for those of you who have played this or have experience with it, I'd love to hear from you on our message forums. A lot of people are waiting for Animal Crossing Wild World for the Nintendo DS. We have some new information, some new artwork, and information about the multiplayer. A lot of people are Animal Crossing fans, so I'm going to talk a little bit about it. When players are within wireless range of other people who have Animal Crossing Wild World, they can travel to one another's towns. One person will be the host and open up his or her town gate to visitors. Up to three others within range can exit their town gates to travel to the host town, where they can do all sorts of things, fish, write letters to town folks, shop at the store, cut down trees, etc. Up to four players can interact in real time, communicating with text, message, and emoticons. All players must have game cards for multiplayer mode. After players visit another town, the following events may take place. One of the characters in the town they visited might move to their town, and a character from their town might move to the other town. Blah, blah, blah. You get the idea. That's the local area stuff. The Wi-Fi connection, wireless multiplayer mode, plays the same as local area mode, except the players connect using Nintendo's Wi-Fi connection. Players must know one another and register one another to their friend roster before they can connect. This is great stuff. For example, if Player A plans to visit Player B's town, both Player A and B need to register each other's names. The friend roster window is available anytime during the game, and there are two ways to register. Register using local play first, right? Or you can register using a friend registration key or password. Players receive friend registration keys when they register their games with Nintendo Wi-Fi connection. They can exchange the friend codes with others by phone, email, online bulletin boards, etc. to add friends to their list. Now, this is very much like a system that I personally was planning on putting together for my own PC games to be able to play person-to-person over the internet. I'm really glad that somebody decided to move forward and use my idea, which continues to make me think that people monitor my message forms. But what do I know? Anyway, so enough about that. If you're an Animal Crossing fan, you're going to want to get in on that. GameMachines.com with a hyphen, GameMachines.com. This is a very nice encyclopedia-style look at many, many consoles, many, many video games. This is nice. This is a nice, clean, easy-to-look-at site. Very lightweight. I really like it. They cover tons of consoles, including Odyssey, Pong, Telstar, Channel F, RCA Studio 2. If you haven't heard of a lot of these things, that's cool because you can go here and learn about this stuff. The Adventure Vision, Arcadia 2001, the Milton, the Vectrex, the ColecoVision, all of this good stuff. The Atom. I'm very pleased to see a site willing to go through the whole historical lesson in video gaming. I really do believe that history is an important thing, and I think that a lot of the future leaders, the people who are trailblazing the way through technology, are consistently forgetting about history. I just don't believe you can see far into the future without being able to look into the past. Last month we talked about videos, like old commercials, things like that. More people have come up and posted commercials. This is called YouTube.com. And this is a series of old Atari commercials, the Atari ET Christmas ad, Pole Position commercial, all sorts of cool stuff in here. Again, if you're into downloading old videos from, you know, the days when we grew up watching TV, this is one more place that you can get your fix. Here's a very interesting game. I actually had a chance before I got too busy this month to download and look at this title. And again, I'm probably not going to pronounce the name right, but hey, sue me. It looks like Cyclus or Cyclus. They call it an exploration adventure game. It's very small. It's 2.6 megs. It's at version 1.4. And this is a game that I'm really not sure I can explain to you. Go to the site and take a look. It's a very primitive looking game that you don't really do a lot. You walk around, you try to get past things, so it's kind of puzzle-ish, kind of platform-ish. There's something weird about this game. Not weird in a bad way, but there's something about this game where you go, this is really kind of bizarre. And anytime you can look at a game and say, that's bizarre, there is credence. There's something good about a game that you can look at and say, man, that is really crazy. This is a game that I sat for, I must have played 45 minutes before I kept track of time. But it's wild. I mean, go look at some of the screenshots and you're going, that kind of looks weird. That kind of looks crappy. But it's got some cool music and it's an interesting experience all on its own. I'll leave it at that. And you should definitely spend a couple of minutes, download it small, check it out, because I think you will agree with me that it's a weird, wacky, wild game. Man, what else do we got? The list is finally starting to dwindle here. For those of you who may have been interested at some point in time writing your own Game Boy Advance games, which could be run, of course, on the Nintendo DS, We have something called the Catapult Development System from Nocturnal Entertainment. It is a development system which is used to write software and games from the Game Boy Advance. For the Game Boy Advance, includes an editor, debugger, simulator, and an extensive set of tools. It's based around a custom language which was designed from the ground up for GBA development. This is kind of interesting. Listen to this. How does it work? Development takes place completely on a PC. A single-click export facility generates a build file, which can be seamlessly built into a GBA ROM. What you see in here on the PC is identical to what you get on a GBA. It currently runs on any Windows-based PC and does not require a fast computer. Mac OS X and Linux versions are in development and are scheduled for release next year. A Nintendo DS version is also planned. You can download a free version, but it does not build the ROM images. So that kind of sucks, right? Well, obviously that's kind of their hook. The interesting thing about this is you can actually build this thing, and for a price, you can crap your build over to the company, and they will shoot you back an actual cartridge that you can play on your unit. And I assume that they have distribution centers and things like that where you could probably actually get a short run of your game made on cartridge and sell it. Ultimate Arcade Games for the GBA, which is about to be released, was completely created using this development system. So this is cool stuff. I mean, hey, empowerment to the people. That's what I say. You want to get rid of giant development budgets and all this other problem of big business running video games? This is the sort of thing that brings video gaming to the masses, brings development to the masses. People can actually, people can actually write games for this stuff without paying billions and millions of dollars. On Saturday, December 3rd and Sunday, December 4th at the Warden's Cricket Club in the UK, we are going to see the Play for Charity event called the Retro Ball, a weekend of gaming, socializing, and competition. Come over for the weekend and step back in time with us as, once again, we relive your childhood and raise money for Everyman. Now, I'm not sure what Everyman is. Ah, I see it right here. It is a male cancer society to help cross out male cancer. Anyway, they're going to have arcade machines, consoles, pinball tables, home computers, main cabinets, and more. Lots of competitions, meet interesting people, etc., etc. Let me see if I can tell you exactly where this is. I am not a geographic dude when it comes to the UK. I'm trying to see if I can find an actual location here for you, because there's a lot of my listeners. I love you guys over in the UK, but my geography is not tight over there. Okay, I've got this, but I'm not sure it's going to help any. The Warden's Cricket Club, located Glasshouse Park, Glasshouse Lane, Kenilworth, Warwickshire. I'm not sure where Warwickshire is, but they've got a map, the whole bit. You can see where it looks like it may be nearby Birmingham, right? Within 20, 40 miles from Birmingham. So anyway, good stuff. I mean, the UK folks are actually getting to have more and more events that we're not getting over here. Good for you guys. Maybe somebody who attends that can let us know how it was. Come to the forums, drop me a line, whatever. But I definitely want to plug people doing stuff like this, especially for charity, especially when it's retro gaming. Looks like it'd be fun. Sorry, no, I'm not going to make it over. It's a big trip for me. What else do we have here? Tons and tons of stuff. Here's an article called The Birth of Paradroid. This tells you pretty much everything you want to know about Paradroid. Now, I was never a Paradroid fan. I know that disappoints tons of people. I never got into the game. I never could get into the game. Tons of people love it, so I'm putting it out here. Tons and tons of links and information about Paradroid. This is good stuff. I would definitely recommend looking at it, although we probably could have done the website a little bit better. But you're not here to comment on the website. But it's interesting. This is sort of a diary about it while the guy was making the game. So this is the sort of thing that you don't really get to run into very often. Not too many people chronicle in depth their game development, right? So this is kind of cool stuff, especially for a game that's so loved, beloved, and well-known as Paradroid. I'm offering up some links to GP2X stuff. You'll probably have not yet heard it yet, but I do talk about the new GP2X handheld, which is going to be, what I, in my opinion, the savior of handheld emulation. It's not the PSP. It's open. It's easy to work with. At least that's what we're told. I haven't got my unit yet, but I'm going to get in on it. For those of you who are interested in the GP2X as a development platform, they are going to be providing a full SDK free with the unit, so you can start making games right away. Some people have gotten a little head start on here and have created some a nice little site here that talk about how to work with MPlayer, which is the media player on here, how to access the different CPUs on the unit, etc., etc. Development stuff that's kind of like PFM to me. In any event, GP2X Dev will give you some early looks at how you're going to be creating games on the GP2X if you choose to do so. Along with that, GP2 emulation news. I'm giving you a link to that as well. This talks about the latest in development of PC2X emulation and titles. Again, I'm not sure what people are thinking. We've got an embedded iframe within a page with no scroll bars. So hopefully you have a scroll wheel if you want to read anything. But anyway, so this has all the latest information about the Quake port, Duke 3D, some of the other little things that we talk about in the GP2X portion of the show. Good stuff there. Let's see. Apparently we are shipping. So, for the GP2X. Good stuff. So I also have a link to a GP2X miscellaneous post on a forum. These guys are actually trying to get donations. And again, I'm not sure how I feel about this. Maybe not. But anyway, these guys are trying to get together donations via PayPal for emulation authors to inspire them to write their emulators for the GP2X. There's something kind of weird about this whole thing. You know, emulation authoring and development has always been about passion. And usually when you start mixing passion with money, bad things tend to happen. These guys' hearts are in the right place, though. You can read about it. They're trying to get this guy named Skeezix, a.k.a. Jeff Mitchell, who's the author of so many great emulation and homebrew projects. He was the responsible for Castaway, which is an Atari ST emulator, and some other stuff. And anyway, there's some information about this. If you're interested in donating or seeing what you can do, I'm sure every little penny helps to these guys. At the same time, you know, you're kind of paying for emulation in some weird way, and I'm not sure that kind of runs savvy with me. But make up your own mind. Decide for yourself. Help these guys out if you feel that's aligns with your own personal feelings on the matter. NES Micro, yet again, another one of those strange concepts. Yeah, here we go. How do you explain something like this? This guy has built an emulator out of an edge connector, basically. Here we go. Sometimes my creation have elaborate origins, like I've been working on the idea for 15 years, or it came to me one day in the bathroom. Bathrooms and cars being places I have most of my best idea bursts. Mine's in the shower, by the way. But I'm sorry to say the NES Micro has had no such stroke of inspiration behind it. Rather, I had an extra NOAC Nintendo on a chip Asian joystick laying around and figured I might as well try to do something cool with it instead of letting it collect dust. As you may recall, last year I cobbled together an NOAC portable. So the thing here was to do something special. As many of you know, I keep close track of Nintendo's monthly Game Boy hardware releases, so of course I knew about the GBA Micro. Then it struck me, why not make an NES Micro? Ridiculously small screens and cramped controls shouldn't be only reserved for newer games. So this guy went ahead and built a micro-sized, and this is amazing, the cartridge is like three times bigger than the game unit, a micro-sized NES. Again, I totally get wigged out looking at stuff like this. One, because I can never get one, because these things cost like $700 to build, and I'm not paying $700 for a portable NES. But, hey, it's like just slightly bigger than a Game Boy Micro, so check it out. I don't know, man. I wish I had free time to do stuff like that. Here we go. Sexual moments in video game history. This is a look at some sexually inferred stuff inside of video games, complete with pictures. Some of the subtitles make these pictures actually a lot more funny than they are, but it's definitely worth checking out. There are definitely a few moments of potential sexual arousal in video games, especially if you're gay, because a lot of this stuff looks pretty gay to me. But hey, you know, whatever. Whatever. Hey, you know, I'm not here to judge. Here's another escapist article. We had an escapist article, I think, last month, and escapist articles are excellent. This is the Conquest of Origin. This is about how Origin got drilled into the ground by EA. And this, I'm telling you, if you look at nothing else this month, if you read nothing else, if you skim through the rest of the show, I want you guys to read this. This is fascinating, informing stuff, talking about what happened to Origin from the beginnings all the way through, where are they today? And I'll tell you what, that is excellent stuff. I think everybody should take a look at that. Somebody sent me a link to Shadow of the Colossus, and I'm not sure how well I can segue this into a classic gaming, retro gaming radio show, but hey, this is a video game for the PlayStation 2 which has no enemies other than bosses, basically. You fight things that are dozens of times bigger than the screen. And I'm looking at some pictures here. I haven't watched any of the videos, but a lot of people are talking about this as being a cool game. You know, I've never been a big boss fan myself, to be honest with you. The end of the level dude or the final dude. I just never liked the fight through the level, get to the bad guy, figure out some weird way to kill the bad guy, and move on. It's just never been my big thing. You know, but it's integrated into so many games, even like Star Wars Episode 3 on the Nintendo DS, right? You have to fight Dooku at the end of one level, and it's all the same deal. You figure out the pattern, you execute the pattern, you mess up the pattern, you end up getting smacked around, you repeat as necessary. This sounds a lot like that, only they've tried to throw some puzzle stuff into it as well. So a lot of people are saying good things about it, and I figure somebody took the time to submit it, and it does sort of tie into how video games have been for so long. This time they just cut out the middleman. Instead of waiting for the end of the level, you just play the end of the level all the time. Interesting idea. Talk about it in our message forums, though, because I'd be curious about people who have played it and see what you guys think about it. Here's an interesting article about the addictions of video games and why do we lose our addictions. This guy's talking about how basically he couldn't pry his hands off of Burnout Revenge, and then all of a sudden one day, boom, I just don't have any desire to play it anymore. Okay? So there you have it. This is an interesting article on addiction. I thought it was interesting. It's short, well worth taking a few moments to take a look at it. Here's something called Pure Ownage, Taking Noobs to School Since 2004. Again, this is not something I had time to take a look at, but this has got to be a joke of some sort. This whole site is written like in leet speak or like shorthand cell phone stuff. Drives me crazy. Starting to read this stuff makes me want to actually take a piece of rope, fashion a well-made noose, throw it over my neck, and then hop over the edge. Anyway, I don't know. I'd be more curious to have someone else look at it and tell me what you guys think of it to see if this is a cool thing. I like the concept of owning on the newbies, but I don't know. This looks like it's, I don't know, there's something kind of creepy about this thing. It sort of looks like Eminem hooked up. I don't know. I'm not even going to go there. Anyway, if any of you have checked this out, let me know if I should pursue getting the videos and stuff. There's something creepy about it. Somebody sent me over a link to a cell phone game or a mobile game called Happy Tree Friends Spin Fun, which I just can't get enough of that title. This is basically a game. Let me read this to you because this will pretty much sum it up. Do you ever sometimes get the urge to just go out and kill those irritating kiddie TV personality with all their cutesy theme songs and big cheesy smiles? I mean, it's one of those days where one is feeling depressingly psychotic, and then along comes this cute, cuddly, furry animal with big, wide eyes, shiny white smile, hopping along, sharing inane, senseless tune. Does it bring out the wolf in your otherwise sheep heart? Well, for those who get those urges, fear no more, as this substitute has been brought to the mobile world. Those cute, cuddly, and often horribly killed animals are now available for your sadistic pleasure. Mission of the game is rather simple. All you have to do is spin the merry-go-round occupied by one of three Happy Tree friends of your choice. Throw that critter along a stretch of dirt road filled with all sorts of encounters, filled with lethal intentions. I don't have a cell phone that'll play this, folks, so I can't tell you. But apparently it's very much like an interactive Flash movie. And I don't know, man. The screenshots look pretty good. There's nothing more fun than taking cute little animals and doing things to them, right? This is for the fledgling serial killer in you all. Definitely check it out. I wonder where Bundys come from. This is where they come from. This is kind of cool right here. Nintendo joined up with a group over in the UK, LostDoggies.com. These guys are actually working with Dog Trust, an organization that never destroys a dog's health, been caring for dogs for 114 years, formerly known as the National Canine Defense League. A dog is for life, not just for Christmas. What a great slogan. That's great stuff right there. Anyway, these guys work over in the UK. Again, I have lots of fans over in the UK, and I'm a big fan of the UK. Nintendo, in a media marketing crossover thing, is working with this group to try to promote good dog ownership. I think they even donated some cash. There's a big hookup between Nintendo and these guys. And I think that's cool. I think it's cool to take... I mean, obviously, this is a marketing scam from Nintendo's part, but certainly the dogs are going to benefit from this, and I'm a big fan of dogs and animals in general. You know, I got four ferrets and cat. Had a dog and another cat, blah, blah, blah. So we've had a lot of animals. There's a lot of animal exploitation going on. I know a lot of people are like, they're just animals, they're dogs or cats, whatever, who cares? Those of us who are a little more in tune with our furry friends can definitely appreciate what Nintendo at least ended up doing, whether or not it was in their best interest or not. So, interesting article to look at there. The evolution of gaming, computers, consoles, and arcade. This is pretty nice. This is a pretty decent article from ARS Technica, serving the PC enthusiast for over... what's the little tagline say? I can't read it. My screen's too big. 6 × 10²? -2 centuries? I can't see. Anyway, this is an interesting article. They talk about the evolution of sports games, combat games, adventure games, turn-based games, first-person shooters. It's actually a fairly decent article. I would definitely check it out. Tons of stuff in here. They go back to the 2600. They're true to the roots. You got to promote good stuff like that. Somebody sent me a link to something. It looks like, and again, this is all like Japanese or something, so I can't really read it. It looks like some sort of a shooter game, a shmup, if you will. I can't tell the format or anything. It's just a link to some Japanese site, and it's got a download to it. And I'm not even sure you can actually download and run this thing. But the graphic looks intriguing. So, I don't know. I'll include the link. I'll talk about it a little bit. We'll see what happens there. Hey, a lot of people are still big into the Dreamcast, and as well they should be. The Dreamcast was, in my opinion, the last console that had any soul left in it. And we have Dreamcast-Scene.com, and we have a whole bunch of stuff talking about... this is not like the first site that's ever done this, but it's yet another tribute to how well the Dreamcast is still doing despite the fact that it's dead. Lots of articles, lots of reviews, lots of links to emulation, community pages, etc., etc. Definitely worth checking out if you're a Dreamcast fan. Yeah, let's see what else we got this month. Man, it's taking forever. Tedious moments in gaming. This comes from our so-called buddies over at Tom's Hardware. With the gaming industry shooting to over $13 billion in yearly sales, you would think a lack of playable material would be impossible. Seems as if few if new games are pouring out of every orifice that publishers have. Along with these games are new technologies and new hardware such as the Xbox 360 is set to debut later this year, with the PS3 and Revolution following shortly thereafter. PC hardware is blossoming also, and a new specialized gaming hardware coming in time for the holiday season. But are we really getting the bang for the buck? Are we actually getting good stuff? Lately, articles and blogs about games being too hard or too easy popping up all over the place, and at the root of the problem may be something even more simplistic, which may have a bigger impact. Flashy graphics and extreme sound sometimes help a game provide a good return on the price paid, but still, unless the player can get involved at the level high in emotional feedback or at least a distraction from everyday life, we often find ourselves feeling as if we wasted our money. So, you kind of get the gist of what the article's about. Definitely sounds like they're more or less in line with what I've been saying, so give them a little plug there. Yes. Xlib Revolution is a clone of the Dance Dance Revolution game using the Xlib Flash APP by Patrick Pendergrast, hence the name. Unlike most other calculator clones, you're starting to see where this goes, this one features crazy graphics and runs pretty fast. It also includes a level editor that allows for infinite possibilities for the game. This is a Dance Dance Revolution game for your TI-83 or 84 plus calculator. Remember we had a big run on people writing games like Nibble and Tetris for calculators? These guys took it one step further and made Dance Dance Revolution for your calculator. Hey, you know, good for them. Then one more reason why calculators are no longer allowed in schools. But hey, whatever, you know. Yes, here's another article on Australians getting to modify their games for free, or their game consoles free of illegal activity. We'll just skip right on past that. We talked enough about that. Media bias and technology reporting by John Dvorak. You know, a lot of people don't like old John, but you know, the more and more that I read his stuff, the more and more alike I feel he and I are in many aspects. This is very interesting, and I never really thought about this, which is kind of interesting in itself, because I kind of like to fancy myself as keeping track of this stuff. The guy goes on to basically say, how do you expect Apple and iMacs and iPods to not get a gross overshare of media reporting when these people are using iMacs to write the stuff, right? This is interesting. I want to read. This is worth me actually taking a few moments and reading this to you. As big as important as Microsoft is, the coverage of the company is quite mediocre. This is particularly true in the mainstream press. The reason for this is that today's newspaper and magazine technical writers know little about computers and are all Mac users. It's a fact. This is why when Microsoft actually does have a good idea, people look to trash it out of hand. With 90% of the mainstream writers being Mac users, what would you expect? The top columnists in the news and business magazines fit this model too. The technology writers fit this model. The tech writers and tech columnists for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, and Fortune are all Mac users. I could list them by name, but I'd hate to leave one out. Maybe I'll blog them by name. I could list 50. Readers should thus not be surprised by the overcoverage of Apple Computer. Every time Steve Jobs sneezes, there's a collective chorus of gazoontites from tech writers pounding away on their Macs. That's the sort of article we're talking about here, folks. Well worth checking out. I never really made that connection, but it all makes sense. What else do I got here for you? We got tons more stuff. We got a link here to Stella, which is a multi-platform Atari 2600 emulator. I'm not sure what this was tied to specifically, if they've got something new out. Doesn't look like it. Let me take a peek here. I don't want to undershadow this. Anyway, I'll go ahead and just leave a link up here. Stella's one of the oldest Atari 2600 emulators, and it's released under the general public license. So you guys, it's got ports to Acorn, Amiga DOS, regular DOS, FreeBSD, IRIX, Linux, OS2, Mac, Unix, Windows. And I do believe they just released a new version, which is why I got this. that has all a nice new UI and some other stuff, because it was kind of hard to work with originally, but I think they've gave it an overhaul, and that's why somebody sent this over to me. So definitely check it out if you're a 2600 emulation fan. If you're a Stella fan especially, you'll want to check in on this. Whew, we're starting to actually get through this list here, folks. X Gaming, maker of the X Arcade controllers, the arcade quality controllers, is finally shipping their X Arcade trackball. This is a trackball-only unit with a six-button configuration. Was originally one of those kind of vaporware-type scenarios where they were promising to ship it, and apparently it never shipped. Well, apparently now it's shipping. So those of you who are looking for a trackball solution, this might be your salvation. Anyway, I will give you a link to that so you can check out the article over at Engadget. Always interesting stuff to see more arcade quality stuff coming out for us to game on. And now you can set your geek on stun. We have another little interesting goodie from geekonstun.com. Marios, 64 of them to be exactly, a Mario for every occasion. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking you're making Christmas cards this year. You're thinking I am putting together a little company letterhead. You're wanting a little signature graphic for your corporate email. Now we have a Mario for every occasion. Somebody has gone through the trouble of making 64 different Marios here. Let's see, what kind of Marios do we have here? Police Marios, Fireman Marios, Referee Marios, Suit and Tie Marios, we got a Devo Mario, Whip It Good, Mickey Mouse Mario, Abraham Lincoln Mario, Chef Mario, a Ronald McDonald Mario, all in one. Wait a minute! Holy crap, I do believe that there's a John Holmes Mario. Or what's that other dude that did all the porno stuff that's real popular? Ron Jeremy. I bet that's a Ron Jeremy Mario. It even looks like him. Wow, that's kind of creepy. I didn't really look close at this stuff. A Sumo Mario. Sailor Mario. A Mario for every occasion. So Geek on Stun gives us Marios, 64 of them, for your enjoyment. That's way funny, man. I didn't even see it. If you look really close, I swear to God, that little naked dude looks just like Ron Jeremy. That's just way too funny. We talk a little bit about how pricey next-generation consoles are for those of you with unlimited disposable cash at your disposal, which I know there are some of you listening that do have that. Here's a $4,500 Xbox 360 bundle. That gives you the Omega with plasma screen TV bundle. The TV itself only costs $2,000, includes a 360 premium pack, 3 wireless controllers, charging accessories, a wireless network adapter, live subscription, 1-year warranty program, memory card, face plates, and 20 games. 4,500 bones for those of you who just don't know what to do with your late Aunt Tootie's inheritance. You can indeed buy yourself an Xbox 360 for $4,500. Okay. We talked about Philips CD. I don't even know why that's still there. What's up with that? There's a Gauntlet promo movie that was being hosted over at AtariGames.com. We're going to give you a link. I've had endless troubles trying to get the movie, so I haven't seen it, but I'll give you a link anyway. Hey, Gauntlet, anything about Gauntlet's good by me, so hopefully that'll be a good video if you can ever get it down. Philosophy on the Preservation of Video Games. This is good stuff right here, folks. This is a good article. This is, again, talking about, you know, preserving the past to protect the future sort of thing. And I think it's a good article. It's fairly short. It's from Videotopia.com, which, of course, is a good site anyway. So I'd check that out. That's good stuff. I really, truly believe in that. The CV Retro Special. Yeah, this got sent over. This is Consolevania. These are some whacked out guys that do some really, really weird stuff. They've got a retro review video clip. I'm going to give you a link directly to the video, and you can backtrack to the site and look at some of the other stuff, because I really want you to not miss out on this video. It's really weird. They talk about all sorts of old games. They do this weird Bill and Ted UK style thing. It's wacky. It's wacky. I enjoyed watching it, though. I did get to watch this one before I went to show. So, yeah, Consolevania's Retro Special. I got a link there for you. Weird stuff, man. I mean, I love you guys in the UK, but that's pretty wacky. Oh, yes. Judge sentenced gamer to death. Man, I couldn't wait for this to come up. We're down to like our last 20 things to talk about here. I just didn't want to miss out. A 20-year-old who used the Grand Theft Auto as a defense for triple homicide gets sentenced to lethal injection. Looks like we're not totally buying into the fact that the devil made me do it. After all, this guy's going to die, despite the fact that he used Grand Theft Auto as his defense. In August, a jury swiftly convicted Moore of the charges, and today a judge laid down the most severe punishment the justice system allows. Moore will be put to death by lethal injection. Of course, they will appeal the case, which means he'll be on death row like 60 years from now. He killed 3 Alabama policemen, was in detention for stealing a car. He grabbed the pistol of one of the officers and used it to fatally shoot a total of over 3 of them. Yeah. The defense mounted a case based on a childhood full of mental and physical abuse. Well, there's your parenting skills for you, as well as an affinity for violent video games. This guy didn't have a problem with violent video games, folks. His father probably beat the crap out of him. His mother probably raped him several times a week. This guy had other problems. Grand Theft Auto was not responsible for this guy's problems. We're having a big debate about this whole thing, whether or not violent video games are like bad for you, over at the forum. So you should get in on that if this is the sort of topic that interests you. We'd love to hear from you. Glad I didn't miss out on that one. That's good. Evil Invasion. Yes, Evil Invasion is a hardcore arcade shooter with a dash of role-playing elements that takes place in the world of powerful magic, great heroes, and dangerous monsters. This is very similar to some other games that we looked at, kind of like Mutant Storm and some other games. It's an action shooter. Again, I did not get a chance to look at this game. Flair submitted this for us, and I haven't had a chance to look at it. But apparently, it's very similar in vein to some of the other games that I was not overly excited about. So that kind of kept me from taking a look at it. But, take a look at it. If action slant RPG is your thing, which usually it's mine, so I'm going to have to take a look at this eventually, I would take a look at Evil Invasion. It sounds like something you guys would like. Pepsi Invaders. Yes, Pepsi Invaders. This is one of those interesting things right here. This is another one of those rare cartridges that everyone knew was out there, maybe was given away as a promo thing. They took Space Invaders for the 2600, and they kind of reskinned it to show, instead of showing aliens, it showed letters for Pepsi. I do remember this one. I do remember seeing the commercials and stuff for it. This cartridge went for 1,825 bones. 1,800 bucks for a rare Pepsi 2600 cartridge. Don't say that video games aren't an investment. You can make some good scratch with this stuff. Another game sent over to me, I do believe by Flair, is Star Defender 2. Maybe it wasn't Flair that sent this one over. This is a mouse-controlled Galaga Warblade-style game. I asked a couple other people who played it too. You know, I did get to play this one now that I think about it, because I was talking to one of the other guys about it. And while the game itself is very visually appealing, it's one of those games where you've really felt like you've been there kind of before. For some people, that's a good thing. I've been there before. It's comfortable ground. It's a standard shooter with pattern-falling aliens, etc., etc. It definitely looks good. So if you're at all interested in the Warblade slant deluxe Galaga style games, which a lot of people are, this is probably worth taking a look at. I played all the way through the last boss, the first boss. You know, I just didn't have a big draw to go back to it. You know, I don't know why. Maybe it's just me. So take a look at it. Discuss it on the forums. Worldhistory.com provides us with a timeline of video games. And video games and computer games in reverse chronological order, starting in 2004, hailing all the way back to 1860. So this is actually some interesting stuff here. When did Hasbro start? When did Nintendo start? How did Sega start? All sorts of interesting stuff in here if you're interested in video game history, which everybody should be. Here is, let's see. I don't want to save that one. Here's yet another Nintendo Minute talking to George Harrison, the senior VP of marketing at Nintendo. This guy talks about Nintendo being the sleeping dragon of the gaming industry. We're not going to talk about the Nintendo Revolution anymore. I've given it enough airtime this month. But suffice to say, if you're interested in that sort of thing, you definitely want to get down on that. HowStuffWorks.com also put out an interesting article about the Nintendo Revolution, what sort of things are inside, how the controller works, things like that. That's always a fun site. HowStuffWorks.com is a lot of fun. I send my kid there a lot to look stuff up. It's good stuff. Let's see, what else do I have for you here? I've got a couple things I'm trying to save till the end here, and I just keep popping up in my list. Let me see what we got here. Somebody sent me a link to Xtreme Radio from the UK. These guys have apparently more than 700 high-quality radio stations online for free. Xtreme Radio is one of the most extensive radio players of the moment. Besides listening to your favorite radio station, it allows you to record music. Player contains over 700 international pre-programmed radio stations, which you can leisurely listen to while working on your computer. With the integrated MP3 recorder, you can easily record music or your favorite program from the station of your choice. Besides being a radio player, XM contains useful facilities for browsing the net. They mention all this comes in a small 2 megabyte package, and it's totally free. Now, I have not had an opportunity to look at this. So it says there's no spyware. It's been certified by some anti-spyware company. I'm sure there's got to be some catch here, folks. But if you're interested in internet radio, internet streaming type music and audio, this is probably for you. Again, from our good folks over in the UK, always a pleasure to see more UK involvement in this sort of thing. Blockworks. Now, this is kind of an interesting game. I haven't had a chance to look at it, but it looks interesting. Blockworks is the award-winning virtual construction toy. It's a huge success among kids and adults alike, with more than 700 carefully drawn parts that can be stacked and grouped in infinite ways, allowing endless building possibilities. This release enhances the fun with animated blocks, ambient sound, and lots of colorful backgrounds. Build as many models as you like, houses, trucks, cranes, mechanical devices, planes, spaceships, structures, automobiles. The possibilities are limitless. So this is basically virtual Legos, folks, but of course they can't call them Legos. They end up getting sued. But anyway, Blockworks, this looks interesting. I'd be curious if anybody's had any experience with that. Interesting stuff right there. What else do I got here for you? Who decides what innovations go into your PC? This is an article written by Bill Gates in 1997. If you're at all intrigued by what I just said about him declaring who puts... This is basically him saying, antitrust laws are bad, okay? So I definitely give this a read. If nothing else, it's entertaining, to say the least. I just love it when people fight like this. Hey, I'll tell you, imitation loves nothing more than innovation. Boy, I thought I was not going to be able to get that out. Imitation loves innovation. There's already somebody working on something called Pocket Dogs for the Game Boy Advance, which is going to try to simulate the Nintendogs experience on your GBA. I can tell you right now, don't waste your time. Nintendogs works because it's a tactile, touching experience. You're not going to make this work on a Nintendo Game Boy Advance. Hey, but you know what? Keep trying, folks. Keep trying. I gave you a link to where you can get to that. Let's see. That article is dead. Hey, what can I tell you, folks? This stuff comes and goes quickly. In defense of Jack Thompson. Okay, we've got a whole bunch of Jack Thompson stuff on here, and frankly, I'm not going to cover a whole lot of it. There's been so much media and so much talk about this stuff, it's almost embarrassing for me to even start addressing this stuff, because there's so much of it out there. I'm getting sick of hearing about it, to be honest with you. Basically, for those of you who are not in the know, Jack Thompson went out and said, maybe we should have a video game that allows people to hunt down video game makers and kill them instead of hunting down policemen and killing those guys. Maybe we should make a game where the press and everybody else that's involved in promoting violent video games gets shot in the head. And this is all, you know, if you've been following this stuff, you either buy into the guy's stuff or you don't. Me personally, I don't. There are people that do agree with him, and there are people that do not agree with him. They've actually got t-shirts now that say, I hate Jack Thompson on it. And, it's really funny. There's a lot of political intrigue surrounding this. Things that he said that are contradictions to things he said before, blah, blah, blah. There's a whole bunch of stuff behind this thing. And here's some things about... Here's another article. I've got one, why people agree with him, why Jack Thompson is right, and why he's not right. This is actually one I'd like to take just a moment and talk about, because this one probably is worth looking at. You can't do a news feature about video game sex and violence without interviewing Jack Thompson, an attorney who saw firsthand the informative influences of pop culture after being hypnotized by the Beach Boys' 1968 hit Frivolous Lawsuitin'. But the key to understanding the anti-gaming activist is admitting that, to an extent, he's right. So, the top five reasons why he's right and why he's wrong. I'm going to read you the reasons, and I'm going to touch on each one of them a little bit. Number one, yes, entertainment can change your personality. Number two, real cops have a right to complain. Three, most games do appeal to the worst in us. Number four, the future is scary. Number five, we do have real murders linked to games. So those are the five reasons. Now let's talk about a little bit about these in each thing. Number one, entertainment can change your personality. Please, please stop dismissing every debate involving censorship with "it's just harmless entertainment, it has no effect whatsoever." Have you ever heard a song that made you sad? Have you never cried at the end of a movie? Blah, blah, blah. So basically the guy's saying, yes, these sort of things can influence your personality. My feeling on the matter is, you've got an innate personality. Okay, and this is something, you know what, I'm not even going to discuss this. We've discussed this at great length on the message forums. I don't want to talk about that at great length. But the guy also follows up with, let's finish the reason why he's right. In fact, the whole part of any entertainment medium is to change the audience to manipulate their senses. Why is he wrong? For the same reason, video games are no different. You're not playing yourself in Grand Theft Auto. You're living a story through a character, just like a film or a comic book. This is the fatal flaw of censorship. There's no logical stopping point. All drama contains conflict, and much of the conflict is expressed as violence. Ask any Shakespeare fan. Besides, will any game train me how to get away with a crime as well as the average episode of CSI? Where do you stop when you start censoring games? Real cops have a right to complain. Jack was trying to make the point that the game industry should make I already talked about that. To make a game where real dads and brothers and husbands who do work as police officers turn into faceless targets like stormtroopers from Star Wars, all for the point of making a profit, is at a human level an ass-holy thing to do. That's a quote. I didn't come up with that word. Why is he wrong? If there's such a game out there, I haven't played it. The entire attraction of Thompson's Whipping Boy Grand Theft Auto is that you make choices. The moral lessons of the game are, in fact, infinitely more true to life than a game where you can only do the good deed, where the A button only makes you kill a bad guy and rescue a princess. Your only choice is to rescue her and stand there and do nothing. You can't rape the princess. So how can you say the gamer in the Mario did a good deed when he didn't have any choice in the matter? For a game to teach kids about consequences, wouldn't there have to be a button on the controller that lets you do something terrible? Absolutely true. You know, I totally agree that there are no real black and whites in terms of what's bad, what's good, what's evil. You know, there are things in Grand Theft Auto that are brilliant. I mean, there's things that you should look at Grand Theft Auto and take away from it going, that is brilliant work. That's brilliant logistics. That's brilliant scenarios. I mean, there's tons of brilliant things. Okay, you can kill hookers. All right, you can shoot police officers. But I'm telling you right now, if you don't do anything wrong, which of course you're eventually going to do because that's part of the game, but if you don't do anything wrong, you don't have police officers come after you. There's no reason to shoot them. You know what I'm saying? So I find that particular area interesting. Games appeal to the worst in us. Can anybody deny that game makers make a profit from hormone-driven urge to define manhood through violence? Look at how the chick's boobs jiggles when she gets kicked in the face. Girls are even hotter when they're in pain. Why Jack's wrong? This is my favorite graph. It shows how violent crime has plummeted since starting in the early 90s, exactly the dawn of the first-person shooter game. Games are violent, but so are comic books, and so are old westerns that used to populate television in the 50s. So are our movies. If B-grade grindhouse entertainment has the ability to cause crime, then the Crusade should have started long before red pixels of blood spewed on the screen. The future is scary. The reason, of course, that Jack fears Grand Theft Auto but didn't fear watching deadly gunfights on Bonanza is because he grew up with the latter one, thus it's familiar to him. GTA is new and unfamiliar. Unfamiliar is scary. It's a human trait as basic as hunger. Or look at it this way. One time in video games, we could kill a little girl that looked like this, and they show a 2600 character of unimaginable origin. On the Xbox 360, you'll be able to kill this girl, and they show a very nice, high-resolution rendered chick. And then, when you have kids, they'll be killing a girl who looks like this, and they show an actual photograph of a girl. That is, they'll be able to simulate the exact sense experience that comes with killing a real human being. You just need the right amount of processing power and memory to do so. This, folks, is one thing I've never understood. People keep wanting more realistic graphics, more realistic graphics. The more realistic the graphics get, the harder it's going to be to get a game that you want to play put out on the market. When a chick looks like a 16 by 16 pixel sprite, you're going to get away with shooting her in the head. When she looks like this chick on the 360, people are going to start screaming. When you can actually kill a photorealistic person on the screen, you won't be killing photorealistic people on the screen anymore. I promise you, if you continue to stress and stretch and aim for the most realistic graphics possible, the clamps and the censorship will proceed inversely proportionate to how realistic the graphics are. I guarantee you, you will never see a game where you can realistically murder somebody that looks real. It's not going to happen. It's a scary thing. Now, why Jack is wrong, according to this guy? There's a book called Teaching Kids to Kill that activists are always quoting. It's by a military expert who claims that first-person shooters use the same techniques to desensitize kids to murder that the U.S. military uses. There are two problems with that, though. An FPS doesn't teach you how to handle a real weapon. Shooting somebody with a pistol and shooting somebody with a gamepad are completely different experiences. And two, Grand Theft Auto isn't an FPS game. And if merely watching two little characters on your TV screen shoot each other trains us to kill, then primetime TV has already made us a nation of killers. Anyway, you can continue to read number 5 on your own, some other stuff. Here you go. I mean, it's an interesting article. It talks a lot. It surmises a lot of the whole Jack Thompson thing. Like I said, I got tons of articles about that. So I wanted to make sure that I at least addressed it on the show, because I certainly didn't address it in the forums very much, although other people have. So if you want to get involved in that discussion, it is available to you on our forums, along with a billion other things that we talk about every day. The guys over at Loading Ready Run came up with a very nice little public service announcement against Hugh Boll, who is responsible for pretty much most horrific video game to movie translations, including things like, House of the Dead maybe was one of them, I think. Let me pull up a list here. He's going to be doing Far Cry, Blood Rain. He did House of the Dead, Alone in the Dark, 2005. So they're... they're having a good time with him. And actually, there's some pretty funny stuff in here. It's basically a old-school public service announcement scenario where one of the guys from Loading Ready Run gets up and does this video clip. It's pretty funny stuff. I mean, if nothing else, they take some nice jabs at some other things, which are pretty funny. So you'll definitely want to check that out. Good stuff. Takes a little while. We all know that Retro Gamer, the magazine that we basically sponsored a lot in the past. Our show has appeared on their cover disc. Went away. Live publishing kind of went away and took Retro Gamer with it. Since then, a couple of different groups have looked into reviving the whole retro magazine scenario. Retro Survival at retrosurvival.co.uk is one of such groups that are looking to bring in all the stuff from Retro Gamer that never made it to print. It really looks like they're trying to continue the saga from Retro Gamer into something new. They are pre-ordering. You can actually order this guy now. They have a whole bunch of articles in here. What's listings of the articles that are going to be in there. Talking about, one of them is the Amiga 1200 and CD32. So those of you who are big fans like I am of that stuff, you'll definitely want to check this out. So, Retro Survival is one of the companies that's looking to carry on the Retro Gamer legacy. So we'll give you a link to that. I would definitely recommend pre-ordering. Put your money down and support companies doing this stuff. Another company looking to bring back the love of retro gaming is retrobytes.co.uk, retro-bytes, and they are a publication dedicated to retro gaming, collecting, emulation, and computing. Our aim is to give you a magazine that puts fun at the forefront of the retro world, so why not join us on our journey through history of electronic entertainment? These guys are also pre-ordering their issue, so it looks like despite the fact that we lost a magazine, we're going to get possibly two more. So, good stuff. I mean, both groups look intent on carrying on the legacy, and you know, you just can't fault that. You just can't fault that. Here's something fun too. Somebody has come up with Prince of Persia. Remember Prince of Persia? I know I've reviewed the game a bunch of times and I've talked about it. Somebody came up with a Flash version of Prince of Persia. And I'll be honest with you, it's pretty good. I mean, it doesn't look like a Flash game. It looks like a regular old... It looks a lot like the Super Nintendo version of it. Anyway, you can play it right inside your browser, Flash, keyboard, the whole bit. Very impressive. It's a little slow in spots, but overall, this is a great experience. To see games that look like this brought over, it's good stuff. So check that out. I'm a big Prince of Persia fan, so you want to take a look at that. Man, we're starting to finally run out of stuff here. Let's see. I got a couple more things to talk about. Here's another article on the war on game pirates. Another interesting deal. It's estimated that more people downloaded Doom 3 the weekend before it was released than bought it in the first few days it was available on the stores. This is the extent to which internet piracy has affected the game industry. Surprisingly, piracy is a bigger deal in gaming than music because gaming rests on a much more financial, risky structure than the music industry. As fast as you can say DRM, we are spiraling downwards in an arms race between pirates and developers seeking to protect their code. So you kind of get an idea what this article is about. Talks about copy protections, all sorts of good stuff. It's an interesting read. Certainly, we need more press on the subject to be sure. Here's an interesting little video. So it's a funny video. There's apparently a knockoff company over in Asia somewhere that specifically makes crappy games shaped like whatever's hot on the market right now. They've made a PSP knockoff and they've made a Nintendo DS knockoff. And they look exactly like Nintendo DS's and PSP's until you actually turn it on. And then it becomes like a crappy game and watch game. It's really funny. You've got to watch this video. This is the one that I think duplicates the Nintendo DS. You got to see this stuff. I mean, it's hard to believe that anybody would fall for something like this. But you got to see it to enjoy it. Microsoft's midlife crisis. Microsoft Steve Ballmer, Microsoft's cheerleader and chief executive, takes the stage at Georgia Dome in Atlanta to stoke the spirits of 10,000 faithful at the company's annual sales meeting. Win, drive, innovate, and press, he shouts, his forehead glistening under hot stage lights as ponds of sweat soak the pale blue shirt on his barrel chest frame. But there's a way for people to keep score. Billions, billions, billions. If you want to grow, things that rhyme with billions are goods, he roars, sprinting up and down the aisles to trade high fives with starstruck salespeople. It's an interesting article. They talk kind of about, you know, how things are different than they were in the old days and, you know, what Microsoft was like, what's wrong with Microsoft now. Microsoft is a visage from the past, et cetera, et cetera. They talk some numbers. Microsoft has become what it used to mock, says one of them. At late night rounds of poker with Bill and Steve in the mid-80s, he says, we laughed at IBM. They had all this process for monitoring productivity, yet we knew they had particularly bad productivity. That's Microsoft now. So there's some good stuff in this article. Anything that smacks around Microsoft's got to be at least a little bit of fun. I think I'm done. I think that pretty much rounds it all out. We've ran for almost 2 hours now of Bits and Bytes. You guys said you didn't care how long it ran. We're going to test the theory. See what you guys think. So, Let's see. I'm trying to think if there was something else. There was something else I wanted to talk about in bits and bytes. But I guess it's going to have to wait for next month because, frankly, I am so burned out of bits and bytes this month. I just want to move along to the rest of the show. Anyway, I hope you enjoy what is certainly the longest bits and bytes to date, running at 2 hours. Again, look for the links. Hover over the links on the Listen to the Show page. You should be able to see who the contributors were to this month's show. Big thanks to all of you guys. I'm going to go get some nice ice water and some lemon to suck on because my voice is almost ready to go. Hope you guys enjoy the rest of the show. Well, folks, I think that's going to wrap it up for the October 2005 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. Big shout out to speedhost.com, who takes care of all of our hosting needs. Big shout goes out to GP2X, the team over there building what we hope to be the future killer emulation handheld. Thanks for all the hard work and tight-knit communication that you've given us over the last month or two. It's been really cool. Special thanks go out to all the listeners. You guys are the best. Keep it up with the bits and bytes submissions. We love to see them. And stay tuned next month for yet another edition of Retro Gaming Radio, where hopefully we cover the GP2X, bring you a brand new interview, maybe two brand new interviews from the Classic Gaming Expo 2005. All this, lots more next month on Retro Gaming Radio. This is Shane R. Monroe saying, until next time, keep it retro.